I'm Mark Eccles, chairperson of the Utah Geological Survey Board, and I'd like to call this meeting of the UGS Board to order at 8:33 a.m. on May 1st, 2019. This meeting is being held in Conference Room 3110 of the Natural Resources Building in Salt Lake City, Utah. In compliance with Utah's open meeting laws, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. This recording is classified as a public record. The following board members are in attendance: Mark Eccles, Dave Garbrecht, Rick Chestnut, Sam Quigley, Pete Kilborn, and Tom Faddis. Following board members are absent: Alyssa Richards and Ken Fleck. The following individuals representing the Utah Geological Survey and the Department of Natural Resources are in attendance: Bill Keach, Division Director; Mike Hilland, Deputy Director; Jody Patterson, Financial Manager; Cheryl Gustin, Board Secretary; and it looks to me like Steve Bowman is here also. I don't see anybody here from the public. As a courtesy to everyone participating in this meeting at this time, we ask for all cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices to be turned off or changed to silent mode. Board motions and votes must be reflected in the minutes and recorded by individual board member. Let's now proceed with the agenda, starting with welcome to all of you to first meeting with our new director, Bill Keach, in attendance. Physically.
Still in the other job.
I welcome you all to a really weird weather day. I had 8 inches of snow at my house.
Wow. Eight.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
I just scraped the ice off of my window.
Oh, I had to do my driveway this morning, which is why I needed a bagel when I got here. I'd like to start with the introduction of the new staff.
He's not here.
Well, you can introduce him anyway.
I can introduce him. And I think I have a slide on that. Do you want to advance? Nope. Back up. Well, we're going to come back up. Okay. So, that's all right. So, Pete Goodwin, he joined the wetland as a wetlands mapper in the last month or so. Mm-hmm. Reason he's not here, he had actually had a trip planned before he started the job, so he's off. I think he's off on time away with no pay. if you wanted to come on board. So he worked here, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago as a kind of a intern or temporary time-limited role. And so he was familiar with a lot of the folks, went out to private industry and worked for a while. And so he's back, and Diane's glad to have him on board.
Good.
That's about it.
Sounds good. So the next agenda item is a review of board member status.
I don't have a slide for that. I don't have slides for that. Probably should have. I'm learning the process here. Your names have to go before the state legislature to get approved. That'll actually happen in the June session.
Okay.
In the June interim session. So the point is that at this point you keep serving as if you were sustained. You stay in your positions, and then they'll get ratified in the June interim session. They didn't get him out in time for the May interim session, which will be May 15th. So that's what I've been told.
Yeah.
But other than that, you continue.
And Bill, that's just Ken and Sam.
Alyssa. Yeah.
So they're the ones who are applying for a second term.
Yeah.
Right.
So that will carry on.
Are all in. But yeah, just waiting for confirmation. In the
Okay. Perfect. Does everybody else know when they're time is up?
I think
for their existing
I know
term.
We are up.
Yeah.
We have through this year and next year.
That's right. I'm wondering if maybe at the August meeting, if it would be a good idea to just give us a sheet with everybody's termination date on it.
Thank you, Cheryl. Cheryl will work at that for us.
It's a 3-year term, is that correct?
Four years.
Yep. So now you know.
Remember, now I know.
How long you been in it?
I think it's been 2 years.
Okay, yeah. So you got 2 more years. Good. Moving on, we had an email to all employees, and I got a list of people that had not completed workplace harassment training. It's this online thing.
Is this how to do it or how to prevent it?
How to recognize it and how to not be a participant.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, but the way it reads, oh, I'm going to go down and learn how to do this.
Yeah, that's the way it came out in the email to us. But, hopefully that won't happen. So they said they wanted all the board members to take it. So I wrote back and says, how do they get access? Which they said, well, we're working on it. So I don't have that yet, but when I get it, we'll email it to you. It's something they'll... How long has it? Anyone done it recently?
It doesn't work.
Yeah, 20 minutes.
Yeah. 20 minutes.
Cool. I went to a class that took all day.
Yeah, this is an online.
You go through.
It's fast.
And when you get to be 68 and you haven't been charged with anything, you should get a free pass.
I don't know. That guy from the Sundance Film Festival. He's 75.
He's been charged though.
Can we do it as a group?
Each person has to sign in individually.
Did you have to do this at SITLA?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Is there any concern about passing?
They let you keep answering the questions until you get them right.
I mean, I'm getting up there in age.
If you can't pass that, we'll wonder... No, I want to see
it. I almost forgot how to tie this.
Yeah, no, I didn't. This is the first time I've shown up with it.
Hey, I didn't come with one.
Well, so I'm going to... I thought since we've got to move the back.
Well, you don't have to worry about the training. So when will this, will it be arranged to coincide with a board meeting, or will it be sometime before that?
Probably the next few weeks.
Okay. Right.
I've asked for it. I asked for it.
We'll just receive it by email.
Yes.
And then we do it.
You can do it from any computer.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah.
Okay.
You just sign in and it walks you through it.
They'll have a link. I just haven't gotten that link yet. I've asked for it.
Okay.
But we haven't gotten it yet.
Okay.
They said they'd get back to me, and that was about a week ago. I'd hope to hand it out today, but they haven't delivered it.
Okay. Perfect. So got it.
They want everyone to do it, but I guess they haven't figured out how to give you a login yet. I don't know.
So we'll just get it emailed?
You'll get an email to you with a link. Say, go do this. And you can. I think when you get on, you can print out a fancy certificate if you want it.
I did a Boy Scout one recently.
Yep.
I had one of those, too.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
The new one's really comprehensive.
Okay. Anyway, that's all I have there. Do you have anything else, Mike?
Did you want to mention the information we need on board members for your...
That's a good... Yeah, thank you. So, you know, we're getting a new director, executive director for the Department of Natural Resources.
Right.
Yeah.
Brian Steed. Who's...
BLM.
BLM. It's officially known as acting in the authority of BLM manager.
There has not been a... fully vetted, appointed BLM manager since the beginning of the Trump administration.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mean in Salt Lake District? Or
no.
In D.C.
In Washington, D.C.
Oh, is this D.C.?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the top guy.
He's wanting out of there, apparently.
I don't blame him.
Right.
He's been running the BLM.
Yeah.
Zinke pulled him in. And then after that, you know.
He has an interesting background.
He does. He has a law degree. Well, he went to Utah State as an undergraduate from the Logan area. He did a law degree at University of Utah with a certificate and emphasis in natural resources. He also does an MPA, Master of Public Administration.
No.
Or PhD.
Doctorate. PhD in Public Administration.
From Illinois or Indiana, I can't remember now. Somewhere in the Midwest.
Yeah, Indiana, I want to think.
I think
it was Indiana.
Okay. So anyway,
and he teaches at USU or is taught at USU,
professor of economics or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
And he was also Chris Stewart's chief of staff.
Right.
Okay. So he's got the political background, and he understands the political. I mean, one of the things that made Mike Styler really good, I think, in the DNR was he'd worked in the legislature and he understood how it worked, and he knew the players. Yeah, he was able.
No doubt about that.
Yeah, he was able to get a lot of things done. You know, whether you agree, my perspective. I mean, I haven't known that long, but you know, I enjoyed working with Mike. But so Brian will be coming in. So he was announced last Monday. So he met the 20-day requirement to be noticed. They had to have a 20-day notice before the state legislature could ratify it in their upcoming interim meeting. So anyway, to that end, I've been asked to put together a little summary of the UGS, kind of a 2 or 3 page description. One of the things they asked me for was a 2 or 3 line description of what each board, about each board member.
Essentially a bio?
Really short bio.
Okay, yep. Two or three.
Sure. Yeah, two or three minutes bio. And I went looking through the files that Rick and Pam had, and I couldn't find anything.
We had to submit them initially.
I've been in the oil business for 45 years, and I've never gone to jail.
There you go.
There it is. Yeah, what do they want in the bio?
Just whatever you want. This is where you have free...
It's about you.
Yeah. It's about you. I'm Pete. I live in Price. I work for the BLM.
Retired from the Forest Service.
Retired Forest Service, and yeah.
Community volunteer.
Something like that.
I mean, do they want any technical background stuff? No.
Okay, but you said two or three sentences.
Okay.
I've got to me, that work. Sounds like 100 words or less.
I've got
probably 50 words or less.
I've got many versions that I can just pick one.
Yeah, but a really, really about 100 words or less is probably good. Okay. Anything else I'm forgetting, Mike?
No,
I appreciate the help.
For the,
yeah.
So you just send those to Cheryl.
Send them to Cheryl.
Over to
yeah, that'd be great. Good. We've got the other piece they've asked for done. Okay. They're hoping in the next week would be great. Because he won't be on board until June 1st. He's told us that he probably won't be here much until June 1st as he tries to wind down. I'm talking about Brian.
But yeah, I bet that's a job you can't walk out of, say, see you later.
Yeah. And so, but they're trying to get a book put together.
Yeah.
Of who the division is, what the department is, and what each of the divisions are. That he can. So I've had to put together two or three issues. Some of the issues I put up here, that I'll talk to you, I put in the same document for him. Okay?
Okay.
Fair to you.
On to the next item, which is approval of the minutes from the board meeting on January 9th, 2019. Is there any discussion of the minutes? Everybody get a chance to review them, and does everybody feel pretty good about them, or are there things we need to talk about? I read them last night, and they accurately reflect my recollection of the meeting, so if there's somebody who'd like to make a motion to approve those minutes,
okay,
Pete Kilborn has moved to approve the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, Dave Garbrecht seconded. All those in favor? All right. Anybody opposed? Unanimously approved. And the other thing that needs to be approved retrospectively now at every meeting are the project proposals that we have approved by email in the interim period of time. And there was a list of those in the board packet. Did everybody get a chance to look at those? And again, are there any questions or comments about them?
Well, I have a comment. In general, I think it's fantastic the number of proposals that have come through, and I think it reflects the skill of the UGF staff. I think it's quite a compliment to the employees of the state survey that those proposals came through at this pace and the quality of those proposals.
I went through them again last night because, you don't get the whole body quite in perspective when you just read a proposal and respond to it right away. But the variety of the of the projects is also pretty it's pretty amazing.
It's nice.
They're really good stuff.
It is.
Yeah.
There's no question of that.
Wow.
Any other comments or
discussion? Just so you know, Jody's got them all listed up there. If there's anything. Is there more than one page?
There's a little bit,
Bottom line, everyone's already approved these.
Right.
That's right. And there were a couple interesting ones yesterday.
Yeah.
Good ones.
And we've got more coming.
I hope.
We do too.
We're awarded them.
So a motion would be in order to approve the proposals that were approved by email in the last quarter.
I'll make that motion. Go ahead.
I'll make that motion. We approve the proposals that were
presented. Okay. It's moved by Rick Chestnut. Second?
I'll second.
Sam Quigley seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Again, unanimously approved. So, I turn the time over to the director. his report.
So we already talked about personnel. Go back to that other slide just for a moment. I'll bring it up. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but we did get approved at the legislature for our building block to hire a new database management.
But do I understand you asked for 120 and you got 100?
Right.
Yeah.
We asked, well, to be clear, we asked for 120. The governor's, the Gombe.
Right,
the
trying to get 60.
Said they'd give us 60, and we convinced the legislature to give us 100. So I think that'll be, we can make that work. Well, that's good.
Okay.
So we're in good shape there. And to date, I don't have anybody that says they're going to retire yet.
This year?
This year. Okay. But no one's come yet to me and said, okay, now you're the boss.
You need to know.
We're moving on. So anyway, just that was the update there. Okay. So I put together kind of a list as I've met with my staff. You know, one of my goals, you know, I've been on the job not quite 4 months now. And when we first met, I said, I want you to kind of think about big picture items. You know, what are kind of the big things that might, both looking down the road, and I'll come to that in a moment, what are the big issues? What are the things that we need to think about over the next 5 years? Coming from a bit of a corporate background, we often tended to think in five-year chunks because it helps me decide what year one should be. I know what year five might want to look like. And so coming on board, both in talking with, I know with Mark and with others, talking with Rick, one of the big challenges that we have is a stabilized funding. You know, we ride a roller coaster. We ride that mineral lease. We'll talk a little bit more about mineral lease funding later, Jody will, but, you know, if there's a lot of production on federal lands, then we get 2.25% of what the state gets. We still get 2.25, but if there's not any funding, you know, if there's hardly any revenues coming, then that number goes up and down. And you folks have already been through all that.
Which is, what the state gets is 49% of the actual lease bonuses and the actual royalty payments that are made to
right.
the feds. And then that comes back to the state. The Community Impact Board gets 32%. We and two other entities get 2.5%, and the counties get somewhere around 17
yeah.
or 18%.
Yeah. So I've heard two different numbers. I've heard 2.25 and I've heard 2.5.
It's 2.5.
Is it?
Pretty sure. It's 2.25?
I'm 2.25.
Oh, I believe not.
Anyway, somewhere in that neighborhood.
I'll go look. I have a copy of the statute.
So the point is that revenue has been steadily declining. You know, our access to funds has been steadily declining. And I wasn't here, but with you, with the board, and Rick, you went through.
The brief history of it is that from, let's say, 2000 on, so from the time Rick got here on, he got to ride the roller coaster up from 2000 to 2008. And in 2008, there was a collapse of both oil and gas prices in August or so, and gas prices have never recovered from that. And so there haven't been any gas wells drilled in Utah since about then. Oil prices recovered fairly quickly and ramped way back up above the level in 2008 and then started to decline slightly in June of 2014 and then collapsed on November 30th of 2014. And they've been down as low as West Texas Intermediate price has been down as low as $28 a barrel. And our oil suffers, let's say, a 20% discount to that. So we were under $20 a barrel at one point.
Particularly the stuff from the Uinta Basin.
That's what I mean, yeah. Well, actually,
Cabernet also gets pretty good price.
The oil from the other big producer in Grand County was Fidelity, now is Wesco, and they were taking a huge hit too, bigger hit than we were,
yeah.
honestly. And so during that period of time, the UGS used that annually increasing income or revenue to grow. And we grew from 60 full-time equivalents to 80. And then in 2014, we were blessed by some of the most expensive employees at the survey who saw it as a good time to retire, so that there were a lot of employees that you could keep two of if one of them would retire, and that happened. And we also laid some people off. And so we shrank our... Rick responded very quickly to the downturn, which put us in better shape than some other folks that had the same issue as we did. Yeah. And I, at the time, discussed with Rick whether that was when we should... Because we had to go to the legislature and ask for supplemental money, which we got with no problem. The legislature pretty well likes us. And, I mean, I had the discussion with Rick, should we go tell them now, we'll give you back this huff and puff income stream so that we can live a normal life, and you guys, we'll tell you what we do, and then you tell us what you want us to keep doing and what you don't want us to keep doing. And I felt confident the whole time that I've been here that the answer to that question would be keep doing everything you're doing and we'll pay for it. And so at this stage, we are at a point where the only people who could possibly believe that we should continue on the path that we're on right now are people that don't like Jody.
He doesn't like Jody.
Well, I'm hoping nobody, but I mean, the brain damage that goes with having to... Yeah, I mean, yeah, I've talked to her about this for a long time. And frankly, for the director and for the board, I mean, it's a brinksmanship existence a lot of the time, and it ain't coming back. And I've been saying this since the day it happened, and I'm even more convinced of it now. And there are three sources of revenue that matter under mineral lease money. There actually are 19 leasable commodities that we could conceivably get revenue from, but there really are only three that matter: oil, gas, and coal. And really the only one of those that now matters is oil. Coal has been declining. The revenue has been declining from that. Natural gas is selling, three. The posted price is under three, and the received price for gas going into either the Northwest system or the Dominion Questar system is about $2.40 or $2.45 right now, which... just to put it in perspective, in 2008, I sold gas for $10.51 an MCF. And admittedly, that was a high, but $2.44 is 20 years ago. I mean, it's terrible. And it is not going to improve. And the reason it's not going to improve is that we have so much gas in this country that is better located than our gas is with respect to proximity to the end users, that the pipeline, that the Rockies Express pipeline that was built to move our Rocky stranded gas to the east where there's a huge market, has now been turned around, and it was built to Ohio. We're connected with a network that went to New York and Pennsylvania and south, and that portion of the line between Ohio and Chicago is now moving Marcellus and Utica gas from Pennsylvania and West Virginia back to Chicago. So we helped them build their transportation system, but it's not helping us anymore. And so I just don't see natural gas coming back. I know it's not coming back in my lifetime, and I don't see it coming back in 100 years, honestly. We have probably 200-year supply now, and that's it. The one thing that was on the horizon that looked like it might bail us out was the ability to ship stranded Rockies gas to Coos Bay, Oregon, to Jordan Cove, where there's a proposed liquefied natural gas plant permitting fight going on right now. And it involves not only building a multi-billion dollar plant right on the coast, but it also involves building I can't remember, 100 and some mile pipeline from Malin, Oregon, which is where the Ruby line that exists that goes across Utah and northern Nevada terminates. And that there's a huge opposition to that pipeline, which makes 300 stream crossings or something like that and has to cross the Cascades. So the fight's going to be protracted, and what's really got me discouraged about it is that the price of LNG overseas is coming down. And in fact, a month ago, there was a contract in Japan where the index for the price included the price of coal. And so there's going to be all kinds of innovative pricing on these contracts that are going to make them very competitive. And by the time we get our gas to the Oregon coast, I don't know if there's enough money out in Japan or China or wherever that gas is going to go to make it make sense. So as far as I think I could convince anybody that gas is not going to be a big contributor to our budget. And then oil, which is doing fine. I mean, oil has come back up $65 for WTI. We're taking right now a bigger hit than we've taken in a long time on a percentage basis. I looked yesterday, and I think it's 24%. But there are 6 drilling rigs running in the Uinta Basin right now. And they have taken oil production from a low of 60,000 barrels a day after the price collapse. So the low month was July of 2016. And they have brought it up to about 85,000 barrels a day. Between 9 and 5 rigs over that period of time come and go. But there have been rigs running since August of 2016 that have restored production almost to the 94,000 barrel peak that it was at when the price collapsed. And the oil price, you know, is somewhat, we take a huge discount here. Part of the issue is that we're now above the capacity of the Salt Lake refineries. So the Salt Lake refineries have a seasonal capacity variation for waxy crude oil from the Uinta Basin. And it's lowest in the wintertime. There's no published number, but I'm going to tell you it's 75,000 barrels a day or something like that on a good year. And it's highest in the summertime. And if you're lucky and you don't have a year like we had last year when one of the major refineries, Holly Frontier, was out for months because of a fire, capacity could be as high as 84,000 or 85,000 barrels a day. So we might be right at capacity in the summertime. So in the fall and the winter and the spring, there's been some oil going over Indian Canyon by truck and being moved by rail to the Gulf Coast from Price River Terminal in Wellington. That's been going on since 2013, off and on. The problem for us with oil, the price is fine. Problem is it's not happening on land that we get
on federal land. Yep.
So the activity that's going on in the Uinta Basin right now with those 6 rigs, only one of them is on federal land, and it actually is drilling a gas well. First gas well I've seen in a long time. I don't think it's maybe going to end up being a gas well. I mean, I think it's Middle Fork, which bought out QEP, and they are in a program looking for liquids from formations that haven't normally provided liquids. But the other rigs are running in the Altamont Bluebell area, and the two groups that we care about that get almost no revenue from that activity are the UGS and CITLA, because CITLA has very small holdings. They have some, but very small. I think 7% of the production goes to CITLA. And we have almost none, because hardly any of that land is federal land. It's largely fee land, private land, and tribal land. So the Ute Indian tribe is a big beneficiary of this, and private landowners are. And I believe that that has the potential to change. I mean, what's happened is that technology has... drilling these 2-mile horizontal laterals has made some incredible wells. I think that the average well now is 1,500 barrels a day, and some of these wells are 3,000 barrels a day. And the other thing that's nice about the Utah stuff is that this is technology that was developed to get liquids out of shale plays. So starting with gas in the Barnett and then the Marcellus and then being applied first to liquids in the Bakken up in North Dakota and Montana and in the Niobrara in eastern Colorado, and then ultimately the king of them all, the Permian Basin in West Texas and southeast New Mexico, which is now the largest oil field in the world. I don't know if any of you noticed, but last month the Saudis decided to buy a chemical company, a big chemical company, and to do it they had to pull their pants down with regard to the finances of Saudi Aramco. And it turns out that they haven't been making as much oil out of the biggest field that, what everybody thought was the biggest field in the world is making about 1.5 million barrels a day less than they thought. We all thought it was making 5 million barrels a day. It's making three. It's been making 3.5 for a long time and making more than that down in the Permian now.
But a day.
Over 4 million
a day.
Yeah. So the application of this technology in the Uinta Basin has been really interesting because it's not being applied to a shale. It started out being applied to the Uteland Butte formation, which is a carbonate. And now it's being applied in addition to the Uteland Butte. That Uteland Butte's at the bottom of the Green River. And in addition to that, it's now being applied in the Wasatch, which is a very thick formation and which has multiple reservoirs over a 1,500-foot interval. And the pressure difference between the top, it's overpressured. The Green River is normally pressured. And the Wasatch, pressure almost doubles when you drill into the Wasatch. And then it rises and rises and rises the deeper you go. And so those reservoirs are tight sands. They're poor perm sands, not shales. So when you frack them, you get pretty good results. And one of the concerns in the Permian Basin right now is that the decline curves for these 2 mile lateral wells are much steeper than everybody thought that they would be. And I don't want to get into the weeds anymore than I already am and explain why I think that might be and why it might get fixed. But we don't have that problem. Our decline curves on these wells that are being drilled in Altamont Bluebell, which is famous for having hyperbolic decline curves. A hyperbolic decline curve starts up here and it dives down and then it flattens out and then it goes for 30 years flat, which is what our wells and overpressured wells in Altamont have always done. And these wells have a much more gentle decline. Yeah. And so the net result is that the estimated ultimate recovery, the EUR for the wells in the Permian Basin, those are probably not going to be realized on the wells that are being drilled right now, and ours are looking pretty good by comparison. And so the Uinta Basin, I think, it's not anywhere near as big as the Permian Basin, but as far as the quality of the wells that are being drilled, every bit as good or better than the Permian. And the only issue for the GS is they're not right now being drilled on our land. And as I started to say, when new technology comes in, it gets deployed in the sweet spots where it's easy to make it work. That's how you find out that it works. And then after you've figured that out, it can spread.
So you predict that for pump plans?
I think it's going to spread west and east and south. It can't go north very far because it runs into the Uinta Mountains right away. And to the south and to the east especially, it's conceivable it could end up coming on to federal lands at some point. But it's going to take a long time, and it's not for sure.
So bottom line is someday, out in the future, we might be getting more royalty.
Maybe, yeah. More than we are now. More than we are now, but probably not like we used to get. Now, the other point that I would make is that this railroad project that is by no means a done deal, but it's moving forward with decent funding, and now there's a financial partner in place. That's predicated on increasing production from the Uinta Basin to it from 85,000 barrels a day to at least 225,000 barrels a day, and maybe more. And if that happened, some of that probably come from federal lands. But I still would like what Bill and I have talked about is maybe having this as a pretty significant discussion group with some background information ahead of time and in the August board meeting, because The only real solution that I see to this is to go back to the state legislature and say, you know, look at our revenue. I mean, how can you live this way? You guys are a much bigger shock absorber than we are. Take this money back and just fund the part of us that you want to have. And, you know, we hope you want to fund it at the level that it needs to be funded, that we think it needs to be funded at. And we're happy to defend that. But, you know, if you decide it's not, that's the risk we take to have a stable geological survey where we don't have to face another round of layoffs. That's the worst thing we can do because...
Would you actually say it that way? Because there's a lot of people that don't understand the value of some of the things that we do, perhaps.
Well, that's part of the story we would need to tell.
I don't think
I'd say it to them that way, but I would put together a presentation where
they understand that.
Where each of the people who have responsibility here for a program within the survey would make a presentation to the committee.
Sure, value
and establish what it is we do. Well, yeah, you want to hang on to hazards, don't you? I mean, the big one isn't here yet. We all know it's coming. And the landslides keep happening on a regular basis. I know they don't want to get rid of that. I don't think there's anything they want to get rid of. They like the fossils. Oil and gas is a no-brainer. Mining is still a big thing here. I just don't see education as, you know, kind of in a sweet spot for them.
So our challenge, and we had this discussion yesterday, with a few of us, and including Mike Styler and company, mm-hmm. is that we just need to be able to show in some way or another how we quantify the value.
Yep.
And then what the return on that value is.
Yes.
So that'll be our challenge. That'll fall to us to work on that, and we'll lift you guys right out.
And frankly, not everything that the Utah Geological Survey does needs to have financial value. Some of it needs to be done because, I mean, you know, there are subjects in school that people study that don't lead to high-paying jobs, but they're still part of an important part of a well-rounded education. And geological surveys have always done things because they needed to be done, and nobody else is doing them because they didn't generate revenue for somebody. And we need to make that point as well.
Yep.
Scientific organization.
We've also been challenged with that exact argument to still find a way.
Yeah.
To assign value. We can be creative in that.
Yeah, that's what we need to do, is assign value, but don't go down the road where you have to put a dollar that's comparable to another dollar.
So we're working on it. So it's a thing that I worry. Did you have comments, Steve? I'm sorry. You're the chair. I should
consider the legislature, with Utah being the fastest growing state or in the top three for the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, like you mentioned, hazards and water and other issues, you know, the population's ramping up. You look at the 2050, 2075 projections, they're huge. Those are major issues for the state. You know, the legislature is going to need to fund a geological survey at an increasing rate just to keep up with that demand right there.
Just along the Wasatch Front?
Just along the
Wasatch Front. I mean, really, really from Ogden to Provo and St. George.
As you say, Washington County.
That
population in the state, you know, it just kind of, you know, grew, you know, at a decent rate. And then when you got into the 80s or 90s, that curve really, you know, kind of does the hockey stick in a way.
Well, and we've had enough houses built places where they shouldn't have been built.
Oh, yeah.
And dams built where they shouldn't have been built. And they've all resulted in embarrassing disasters for whoever the regulatory agency was that let it happen. And we ought to catalog those, and that ought to be part of the story. We can help you stop this stuff.
You can monetize that in a negative
absolutely
sort of way.
You can. Yeah. So anyway, I took Bill's thunder away here for a little bit, but that discussion, I would like to have Brian Steed on board before that discussion takes place, and I would propose that we have an internal board discussion with the staff managers in August, and then either have a board group, the whole board, or a few people from the board and the director sit down with Brian Steed as soon after that as possible, so that we can make preparations if we need to for the legislature. And then we'll have another opportunity to be together in September for our field trip when we could. What would be nice, I think, is if we could do it between our August meeting and our September field trip, so that if we have things we all kind of need to discuss again, we could do it in the field.
I know where you're going to go.
The department holds meetings late August in preparation for building block requests. So that's when we would be sitting down with department leadership, kind of outlining our ideas that we may want to take to the legislature. So it's really late August we need to be
That fits into this schedule pretty well.
So Mark, is there anything that is driving why they don't drill on federal lands versus they're drilling on other lands?
Well,
there are two things,
and the fundamental one, 5 years ago I wouldn't have said this, but the fundamental one right now is geology. and the other thing is that it's much more expensive and difficult to operate on federal land than it is on state or private land.
Because of the NEPA process.
Yeah, if the geology were the same, I can't think of a single operator. Can you, Tom, that wouldn't rather be on settler land than on federal land? I mean, it's just a different way of life.
Right, but on the federal side, there's also a lot of litigation with the permitting.
There is.
It drives up the cost.
Yeah.
And you know, the other land you could be on is Indian land, which is where I've operated since 1983. And honestly, you have some nervous moments, but the truth of the matter is that it's a more sensible system, and it's a faster system, which time is money. That's the big problem of the delays. And because the feds have a fiduciary trust responsibility to the tribes, if you just rattle that stick a little bit, things go through more quickly than they would if you were on federal land. So, but yeah, it's mostly, in general, it's difficulty with permitting, which right now is in a temporary hiatus because, you know, we have a more friendly BLM. That's going to change eventually. And I expect we'll see, you know, there's a lot of keep it in the ground protests. We had a protest last week at Sitla, in front of the building, school kids that, you know, pretty sure they all drove there and that they came from a heated house, but, you know.
They don't need energy.
No, uh-uh. They're gonna,
which is a new trend.
Yeah.
They may have come from the high end of town, too.
There's no doubt. And in fact, they may have ridden bicycles because it was downhill from where they lived to where this protest was. I think you're right. But the other thing is that you know, we have multiple candidates for one of the parties right now that have stated that they want to end exploration and production from federal lands. That isn't going to happen either, but it's going to make life tougher.
But it's coming. I spent last year and a half in California, where the Keep It in the Ground movement has taken a strong foothold. I mean, it's got a big presence. So anyway, so my bottom line is we need, and I actually cornered Dave Hinkins, the chair of the National Justice Finance Subcommittee, on this, and he's willing to sit down and talk about it. So he recognizes there's a need also.
Yeah.
Doggins in a similar...
Doggins, except for theirs comes off of state lands, right? They don't get off...
No, Doggins gets 0.02% off of every kind of land.
Oh.
The conservation fee gets applied to Indian land and private land and federal land and state land.
Bill, I'm from Carbon County, and so I know Dave Hinkins quite well. If I can be any use there.
That'd be great.
And our longtime friend.
Okay, good. Yeah, he's from the same town my daughter-in-law's from, Karen. So, anyway, but it's a discussion we want to get started.
Yeah.
Whether it happens this year or next.
That's the point. It doesn't necessarily have to happen this year, but...
It needs to get started.
Yeah, and it may take more than 1 year to get it done.
So let me just... I've served on this board under Genevieve Atwood and Lee Allison.
So you keep coming back?
I keep coming back. And back in the 80s, we had these same discussions because there was extreme variability in mineral lease money, and it made budgeting and forecasting and hiring and operation very difficult. So this is not a new problem. It's existed...
1986.
Yeah,
Same problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Same reason.
That was torture back then.
And again in 1998.
These meetings were very, very difficult because the survey was always under stress. And,
okay.
And I would be, I ever like to see that change. If I did one thing in my life, I'd like to see that change.
So when we get again, let's talk about what are the barriers.
Okay.
Yeah. I want to keep the meeting going, but I'd like to figure out and individually afterwards we can sit down and talk. You know, maybe we have some ad hoc.
And what do we think are the most vulnerable programs, and what can we do to insulate them the most we can? Because some of the programs, it's not going to be an issue at all. Most of them.
Yeah.
But
all of them.
I was just thinking that as we were talking about the growth. Steve was talking about that all this is geologic information, kind of an infrastructure of information that supports that growth.
Right.
All of it, you know, the wetlands programs, hazards, everything. So if you put it that way, you do make the connection with economics but all the programs.
And when I went to the legislature this year, I've been on the job a week, that's kind of the point I emphasized. And I showed them our interactive maps and how to know where the faults and what the geology is before you start building.
And then the importance of mineral and energy development to help generate future revenues that come in under the mineral lease.
And the fact that
the mineral and energy department is extremely important to the future of the state of Utah.
And a lot of those activities are in rural Utah where they're the only really decent jobs that aren't on a government payroll.
That's correct.
Literally.
Okay.
So it's not only just geologic hazards, but it's mineral.
It's all of it.
Yeah, it's all of it, absolutely. And mapping is very important to that, and exercise. And
so we understand that's a problem. We're trying to work hard to reach out on DOE and other types of grants. That's in the back of the last slide, but we're working on grants. You've seen it. You guys have already commented.
Yep.
The folks are not resting. And, you know, Steve goes out on the road and talks to the county agencies to let them know that we're available to help as well.
Well, and the other thing that shrank the same time as mineral lease money did was we had significant contract work with oil companies. And
it's gone away.
Yep. Over the same calendar, it's gone away.
Yeah. For the same reasons.
Yeah, Steve.
The other thing you might want to consider, too, is a lot of these mineral lease counties, the mineral lease money is a very significant portion of their yearly budget.
Oh.
And so as that's coming down, you know, that's a huge political block right there that they're going to be going to the legislature to try to backfill those funds. So I think it really helped us out to go early because we're such a small percentage of that, and they're so much larger. If we get in early, we might get what we want. If we keep waiting and waiting and waiting,
the elephant in the room comes,
that could be a real problem.
Yeah, although the other thing that's in our favor on that is that the counties all charge ad valorem property tax, and there's a component of that tax that's... the ad valorem property tax has two pieces. It's a property tax on the physical property that's on the personal property that's on your drilling locations or at your mine or whatever. And then the other side of it is that the state tries to figure out what the fair market value of the minerals left in the ground is using a discounted cash flow analysis. And so that tax is assessed by the state, but the money goes to the counties. So even on all these Indian and fee wells that are being drilled in Duchesne County right now, Duchesne County isn't getting mineral lease money from those, but they're still getting ad valorem tax, and it's around 5%.
That's good.
Yeah.
Shift in, kind of, again, I've talked about long-term planning, something that I want to start thinking about. You know, and just one example is the core lab. And if you hit the page down, I think there's two pictures that I didn't. Yeah, okay, just one more. Yeah. And you guys have talked about this before, but we've got more people. You know, our core lab is full. Yeah. And our research facilities for displaying it is limited. A lot of people come and use it. I'll be there on Monday morning with a group of engineering students from the University of Utah getting ready for a two-week field course that we're going to run. But we'll be there. That's where that picture on the right is from, was a bunch of students I took there. University of Utah's EGI, sent us a note last Monday. They want to donate to us a bunch of the core they have in their core warehouse because they're going to have to vacate their warehouse. And so, and who was it? Peter was down in Orangeville picking up core that people were donating. So the donations are coming, and part of the dough comes that one, you know, as they leave, they don't want to keep it. So they don't want to throw it away.
Let me say something about core. I've been working for the last several months for CITLA on a contract, developing a helium map and a database for the state. The 2015 UGS oil and gas fields of Utah map has a symbol on it for helium, and it is applied in two places on the map, to two fields on the map. We've developed 88 separate places, separate wells, where there have been helium tests going back to 1923. And so we've taken that map, we got the database from the UGS, and we've taken that map, and all but one of these spots is in four counties, San Juan, Grand, Carbon, and Emery. And then there's one database, one point, and it's a fairly significant one up at Clay Basin, up on the Wyoming Utah border. And so we've expanded the map and cut off the western half of it, basically. You can still see the Great Salt Lake in the city, so you can get oriented, but blown the map up. And in the process of doing this, I have read the well files from Dogham for all of the wells that are on this database. And the work that was done in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s on data collection from Wildcat wells, so much better than it is now that it makes your head spin and you just go, God, those guys were good. And one of the two biggest differences are that they used to core a lot in the oil field. And these wells were all being drilled looking for natural gas and or oil. And core after core after core. I looked at a well the other day, it had 61 core runs in it, 30 feet apiece. That's a lot of coring. The other thing, the reason that I was looking at them is that they ran what's called a drill stem test. And if you're not an oil person, you might not know what that is because they don't do them anymore. So if you're a young oil person, you have to learn. But a drill stem test is while you're drilling, if you get a gas show, you have a geologist monitoring the cuttings and also running some kind of a gas detection equipment, a chromatograph or something like that. And so they can see when you drill gas and they can physically see when you hit oil. And it used to be when you did that stuff, when you saw those things, that you stopped drilling and you pulled your bit out of the ground and you ran in the hole with a packer and you expanded the packer against the side of the hole and then you opened a valve on top and you've just taken away all of the hydraulic weight that's on that fluid so that it doesn't want to come into the wellbore and you've given it a free straw to the surface. And so a couple minutes sometimes you'll have gas to the surface. And you can capture the fluids and you can capture the gas. And some of these folks back in the 40s and 50s and 60s would analyze the gas for helium, which is an extra charge, you know. And that's where most of these came from. And the other thing that happened is that the Bureau of Mines, which no longer exists, and their role in this was replaced in 1996 when they went away by the Bureau of Land Management, they operate the U.S. Helium Reserve in Texas, in Amarillo, Texas. And if you file a well permit for to drill a well, you have to state what your objective is, what formation you want to drill to. So if you drill to one of the formations, say the Entrada or the Morrison or the Dakota or the Paradox that are typically known to have helium in Utah, they send you a letter and they say, when you complete this well, we would like to get a sample. And so let us know when you need it and we will send you a sampling apparatus and a big glass jar with a glass stopper and everything and a set of instructions for how to do it. I drilled a bunch of Entrada wells and they did this for me back in the 2000s. And that's where all this data came from. I mean, almost all of these 88 data points came from the BLM database. And so keeping this core, the whole point is that the number of feet of core that's drilled a year in Utah now is a small fraction of what it used to be. And once somebody cores a well in a neighborhood, that's the last time it's going to happen these days. And so we should accept all this core that people try to give to us.
No, we're trying to.
And, I mean, it has value. And honestly, my wife was on this board under Governor Leavitt back in the 90s or in the early 90s, and they actually had a discussion of why we have the core. Governor wanted to know why we're spending all this money on core here. So let's just get rid of it.
Is the question where we're going to put all this extra core?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And right now we're renting remote warehouse space for some of it right now already.
Yeah.
And
we try not to let that get out.
Yeah. The other comment. Well, you put it in the report. The other comment I would make is that Tom has long had contracts with the UGS for CITLA, for the mining part of CITLA. The oil and gas part of CITLA hasn't for a long time, and we entered into a $30,000 contract, or CITLA entered into a $30,000 contract with the UGS to study the Paradox Formation, just around Moab, north of Moab. And a core study of cores that you have from mining companies, actually, in the same rocks, has been the basis of a lot of this work. And there's a young geologist at CITLA who's graduated from the U last year, who I've been working with a lot. And he's been out here several times with Elliot and Mike Vandenberg. And I've come out twice to look at the core. And when our core's laid out, there's no room for anybody else to have core laid out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
a small area.
Yeah. So we have a problem with core storage.
We have a problem with storage, and we have a problem with working space, both.
So if you look at the picture up there, picture on the left, those are the racks, and every rack is full. And that's from one end to the other.
And that's about half the height of them.
Yeah. And you look on the one on the right, and that area is only about another 8 to 10 feet wider than that. You can get one more row of tables.
Yeah, sometimes they set up down from front.
They'll set it down the aisles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So do we want to talk about what we're going to do about it, or just acknowledge we have the issue?
We did take it to DNR leadership last August when we talked about our building blocks. We just wanted to kind of put it out there, acknowledging that the issue and that we needed to do a little bit more research on cost and architectural, you know, estimate, and then we have to look the legislature. There's a building board. We have to, you know, work things through when we're doing an addition, or so. There's a little bit more work we need to do, but we've got it out there. It's on their radar. Gombe actually came in and toured it. The tour, and so, but we can push it. We're, you know, to the point we can push it further now.
And when I talked about this down at the Uinta Basin recently, Senator Hinkins came up to me and says, "I want to bring the whole finance committee to see the core lab."
Yeah, so that'd be a good thing to do. We should have a barbecue for him there.
So we can do that. And I've sent him a note and says, "Look, we're happy to host you whenever you want." He was going to have Yvonne.
Finance and I spoke to Yvonne after I talked to him about this $60,000 bust up at the legislature, and he agreed to sit down with me after
legislature.
I said, I'll give you the legislative session, and then maybe a couple of months to calm down. But I would like to explain to you why you're headed down the wrong road the way you're looking at this, and.
Okay.
And so I'm going to do that. I got his card, and I'll give him a call. Maybe you want to come to that meeting at the same time. And
I just wanted you at least right now to be aware that we're working on it. If you have some good ideas of how to attack this, I'm all ears. We are all ears. If there's something that we, you know,
But it's a problem that we need to deal with.
We ought to think.
I just had an idea.
Okay, go forth.
It's bizarre. It's a bizarre idea. But in some of these small towns, and I know it's not close by, but if you're looking for over extra storage, you know, in price,
yeah, Kmart, the old WeTech size, huge buildings.
That's actually a better one. There are these places that are
empty,
and probably cheap.
Yeah,
and the motels are cheap.
Yeah,
if people are coming from out of town to look at the stuff,
that
it'll be cheaper.
And cooperation with Utah State because they own
that. Right, and just to add to that, you have field camps coming out from all over the country to that area.
Right.
Yeah. If you also had CORE,
that's a really good
That's a great idea.
And then the only other thing I can think of is I wonder if somebody could do a campaign or canvas among industry in Salt Lake about extra warehouse space, like, for instance, Rio Tinto Canada.
Right.
They may have some.
In fact, they have a wonderful CORE shed. Looks a lot like that, but they also have some wonderful CORE logging space.
Yeah.
Just designed for for observing CORE, but it's all from Bingham.
Yeah.
Is there anything out in Tinnick or anything like that might still be around?
I think that the buildings are mostly gone out there. Price Utah thing around WeTech, and then even around the corner, there's a steel building that's.
It was a coal mine.
WeTech was the Western Energy Training Center, and it was
at the Willow Creek Mine, wasn't it?
Yes,
it's the old Willow Creek Mine.
Oh, yeah.
Above where the.
It's
where the power plant used to be.
Structure, and the state actually bought the building, so the state owns the building.
Ideal.
Yeah. The state owns the building. And it may be under Utah State. It was under CEU before the merger.
You could even put it on the train and just stop the train right there.
Well, moving CORE is a pricey thing.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
The guys at EGI, they're in a warehouse over about 6th South and 6th West. And it's not all CORE, but most of it's CORE. And they sent out to bid to move it to another building in town.
Is it expensive?
$400,000.
But you make up for it, and the storage costs going to be cheap out there.
$400,000.
It's huge.
You know, trucking's cheaper in the Uinta Basin, and price. You might be able to find somebody to make that run for less than that.
Yeah.
There's ways to get those costs down.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what I said. Yeah. There are. You know, if you let private industry do it.
So who would you contact?
I'm sorry.
Well, I was very close to the last president of CEU and the WeTech organization, but I don't know who would be the contact now. I think the contact for Bill probably would be the president of college. Then.
Maybe the way to go through CEU. is with Michelle Fleck, who runs the geology department there, I think.
Michelle Fleck would help. Certainly help open doors. You bet.
She related to Ken?
Yes.
Wife?
Yes.
Okay. There you go.
She's a geologist. Great lady.
So one of my goals, you know, like I said, my first one I came over was to meet all the staff. Meet the program managers, meet the staff. Now I want to start getting out to the different academic institutions and counties and stuff. Once summer kicks, I'm going to probably go on a pretty ambitious road tour. So
one last comment on the CORE thing is that we might want to spend a little time thinking strategically about timing the CORE, the major capital expense for the expansion of the CORE facilities, and whether we want to do that before, simultaneously with, or after we've solved the ongoing funding issues. So that could be part of that discussion.
Yes.
And it should involve the new director.
In the UGS or in the...
certainly you. And,
oh, okay.
But also Brian,
there's going to be a new one of me.
No, I'd like to hear what Brian Steed and Darren Bird have to say about it as well.
Sure.
By the way, Kerry Gibson, does everybody know Kerry Gibson has gone to agriculture?
Yeah.
He was the other deputy at DNR.
Yep, and they've announced a kind of a temporary deputy, Rory Reynolds from Wildlife. He'll be sliding into Kerry's shop if you haven't heard that yet.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. God, are we, where are we on our schedule? I don't know where we are.
We're at 9:30. We're okay. Yeah.
We're okay? Good. I put in here something. I look at our mapping group. I walked in, you know, and I met them all, and I go, those guys are all older than I am. And I can't ask anybody their age. I mean, I guess I could go look up their HR records, but I'm not doing that. My point is you realize that we all have kind of sunsets in our career of some sort or another, right? We may move to others, but there's five of, probably out of 10 folks there that are will probably not be there in, as full-time employees in 5 years.
For some of those mapping guys and gals, the trigger point is not necessarily age as much as it is physical ability and health.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys, if you had a job like that, would you retire from
it? No, it's okay. You know, and Grant, people keep going to Grant Wells, who's the program manager for mapping, and he says, people say, are you still here? And he goes, people keep asking me that. And I go, and he goes, I keep telling people that I'm going to retire when I have two bad days in a row. and that has not happened yet.
Point made.
Are there people out there who would like to fill those shoes?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in terms of, but it's still something we need to plan for. And Grant himself is worried. You know, we have people that are, you know, that do the photogrammetry, you know, that, which is, I mean, I walked in and I saw Kent Brown and Don. Asha. No, Don. What's Don's last name?
Clark.
No, not Don Clark.
John King.
Huh? King.
John King.
Sorry. Sitting there with their stereo glasses on, looking at ArcGIS Pro and Google Earth, you know, trying to figure out the overlays and the mapping of the formations. But those guys probably won't be there doing that in 10 years. It'll be somebody else, and it may be a newer technology. So in terms of succession planning, it comes in two parts for me. What are the folks that want to do it, and what are the technologies that we need to have in place that the younger folks will attract them and they're going to want to use?
Yeah.
So I think about it in those terms. Because,
well, you know, and how can you overlap them so that the people that are doing it now, who would all be wonderful mentors to people
exactly.
who
That's
come out of really colleges that don't point. Teach mapping worth a damn anymore.
They don't. And most of them don't.
But I think our technology is for mapping is actually probably ahead of the curve. You know, yeah. I've seen some of the things they've done with rectifying and old maps and things and using various approaches that are just miraculous.
And Adam has gained this almost legendary reputation of doing historical geology, finding legacy data.
We don't need to worry about him retiring anytime soon.
So, no, I mean, Adam is but my point, Adam is an example of this.
No, exactly.
Of the young guy who's learning from the old folks and he's leveraging the new technology.
I guess the question is there a way? Is there a way to allow people that were in other programs, you know, a sabbatical for a quarter or a half a year to work with the mapping program and go out with Bob Beek and Grant and Adam and people like that?
And those are things we need to think
to decide
about.
whether that's a track that they would like to follow.
Yeah, and so I believe in the same. They refer to that as career mobility.
Yeah.
Assignments. And so like the current deputy director, who even lives in Wildlife, it's a 2-month career mobility assignment, at least for the moment. And so I want to think about that, exactly what you're talking about. And maybe the other thing that I've had a lot of students say, hey, I'm looking for an internship. And I say, I haven't got any money, but if you want to volunteer. And we've got two from BYU, they're going to be volunteering.
Good.
And there are other, I think there's one coming from
Utah State? Coming from University of Oregon.
Oh.
Paid through some NSF fellowship.
Yeah, that one's being paid, but I think Grant's got someone coming from Utah State.
And they're going to go mapping.
Yeah.
With somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're working for Grant, anyway.
In the students that we do hire for interns when we have had funding, we do try to get them out into other areas, so it's not just, you know, one project, this is what you're doing all summer.
Sure.
We've tried to expose them to other things, you know, kind of ask, you know, what kind of backgrounds are you interested in, and there's been a variety of kind of cross-program work on that. that I think has been pretty successful. All the ones that we've hired have pretty much gone on to full-time positions when they graduated, and they said the reason that they got the full-time position was because of the internship.
Right. So the internship plays two roles. One, either helps them get a job somewhere else, which they may not want, but it also can get them inside of our organization and say, I want to be part of that.
It gives you a chance to look at them.
And that's the third leg of it.
That's how Adam was hired originally.
And I think Chelsea kind of came that way.
Yeah.
And Adam's great. I had Adam as a student in a class of mine at BYU, like 10 years ago. And so here he is. There was one I thought of. Can you go back? I'm trying to remember. There was one I thought I had. How was it? Just flipped through my brain. Yeah, and it's not the only program that's going to have this issue. You know, Energy and Minerals kind of went through that career change. But my point is, I'm trying to think about career mobility, and some of those might be pushing some of our folks actually into another agency for 6 months. You know, maybe we go over to the mapping agency to get some of those mapping skills up, the technical mapping. Well, I know where he's going to go. Is that the thing that doesn't happen a lot is that if you ask Grant to take his digital device and go out and do a strike and dip, he won't do that, you know. Because for him, it's faster to get out the brunt and
measure.
Neither
will I.
Yeah, that's okay.
For the same reason, age.
But there are younger folks that may pull out.
Oh yeah,
their phone, and I have it on my device.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, I just discovered.
So anyway, those are the kind of things I think about. Okay, next slide. Sorry.
Oh, one more comment.
Okay, go. You're the
on mapping. Went to a talk at the Historical Society in Park City by Bob Beek on his mapping of. He managed to blend his mapping work in the Park City Quadrangle with the Markagunt gravity slide.
Yeah.
And I left it on the desk with my entire board packet, but I have an article from the Park Record newspaper with a picture and an article about that talk that I'll write down and give to you so you have it for your file. So.
That'd be great. I've been reading Bob's writing, and I've been very impressed with that. All those geosite stuff. He's good. This kind of drops right down into, and I should have added to this, wetlands. But I understand hazards, groundwater, and wetlands.
Yeah.
I left that off. It's on the document I'm sending to the new director. But this is huge. I mean, I went back and looked at the population forecast right when I came on board. And it was 2015, they did a 10-year look, but by 2025, they said there'd be 60,000 new households in Utah County. And over, I think it was 70,000 plus for Salt Lake County. And I think it was like 15,000 for Washington County. That's pressure. That is pressure in a major way. And you've got city and county planners that are... Let me back up. You've got engineers, builders that are pushing for development in areas that they shouldn't be building. And I hate to say this, but you've probably got commercial engineers who, if they say no too many times, they don't get work. And you've got city planners that don't know how to read it. And I pull up the case. I got called in probably 7 or 8 years ago by a law firm. A boulder rolled down in Washington County over by Ivan. Mm-hmm. Landed in the backyard of a $1 million home and stopped in front of a plate glass window about the length of that wall. And it was that, and it stopped about an inch from the window. And the lawyers wanted to know, did an earthquake cause it? Because the homeowner's insurance excluded landslides, but they had an earthquake policy. So the point about it is, but when I got into it and started talking to the neighbors, they had an engineering report that said, that led them to believe that the rocks would only, if they fell off, they wouldn't roll.
Gravity suspended.
Yeah. They would hit the ground and go plop. That was what one of the neighbors told me. And I said, I want to see this report. And I read this engineering report and it said, it looks like the big rocks fell a long time ago when it was wetter. What's a long time ago?
There's an emissions insurance policy that you could go against that doesn't matter whether it's an earthquake or not.
Yes. So my point is that they need really good information. they need guys like Steve and his team that are out there understanding the hazards and how we're going to get there. You know, one person, some of our people said, we need to get the legislature to create legislation that a geologic report is required every time there's a development. It gets delivered to us, you know.
Being on flat ground doesn't eliminate it. I mean, go down to Enoch and walk around on that little disaster.
So there's all kinds of hazards, is the point. So it's just something to think about. Are we going to be able to keep up? And are we going to have the people and the funds to do it?
Yeah.
And groundwater and wetlands are a very similar issue. Can we supply water to this huge thirsty population that's going to explode on us? You know, where does our funding come from, you know? Most of us come research in non-state sources. Do we need to put in our budget a request? If you really want to understand the groundwater problems, I got asked by Mike Styler yesterday, do we have a map that shows how the groundwater tables are fluctuating across the state? Do we have that map?
No.
But we need one.
Yeah.
Coming up. Yeah. by the way, Hugh's here. Stephen Kirby, who's on your list to speak to us, is home meal today. And Hugh graciously volunteered to come and talk to us about Snake Valley. And Hugh, do you all know Hugh? Does anybody not know Hugh?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know if you knew him or not.
I had auxiliary slides that might relate to what we've been talking about just now, so maybe we could do that just out for fun.
Not right now?
No, well, at the scheduled time.
You're saying tonight? Okay, we can do that.
If you wish.
Yeah, that'll be fine. So anyway, these are things that I'm thinking about. These are the things I think that as a survey we need to deal with.
Absolutely.
Okay, next. Your field trip. I threw this in here. I brought it with me.
Nice digital map.
Yeah, we sat down with Don Clark. I asked Don, you know, my understanding was that Don Clark was asked to put something together. And so I went and asked Don, you know, what do you got? So Don came back with this map. So I just took a picture of it.
So we're going to Wendover.
And can you hit the next slide? Mm-hmm. There, that's a zoom up, see, that question is small. But right now, it's a bunch of colored blobs and numbers, you know, kind of a map. But the idea was to go out to the West Desert. Is that what you guys were understanding?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know. You guys were told before.
We're going to look at lithium. I hear there's lithium out there.
Does
for batteries, you know?
There's a plant producing it.
So there's two folks that were going to lead this trip. One was Don Clark, who does kind of structural geology, and Andrew, who heads up in the minerals. He looks after industrial minerals, so that would be one of them. And so these are a range of things. We won't do all of these, but these are ideas that we're kicking around. I think Hugh said that you've been doing, or was it Diane said they may be doing some wetlands projects out there?
They are, yeah, and at Great Salt Lake.
Right, so we may bring something like that in as well, mm-hmm. along the way.
How about a jet car out on the lake?
That raises a whole nother
question. Should be late, that's in August.
That's later in the agenda.
That's later in the agenda. We'll come back to that one.
You know, on the salt flats.
No, we get it, yeah. That's that. Can you grab your cursor and go to the your left side of the map? Come down, up.
Right. That one right there.
Yeah, that's the salt flats right there. So that's a possible location to get out to.
Which has got some interesting geologic future work being done to try and restore it.
Yeah.
Involving
lots of money.
Lots of money in that. She'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just wanted to at least throw it out there. The question was, did we, you know, 2 or 3 days, we might be able to do this, just go out and back and, you know, leave on Friday morning and be back Saturday night. If you guys really want to be gone 3 days, we can certainly expand the scope.
Depends on how we do on Friday night in Wendover.
Stay to win it back, or get home and explain to the wife why you lost it, or the husband, or the kids, or whoever. So I just threw that in there to kind of, you know, it was on the agenda after my kind of big picture thoughts.
Great.
I don't think I have anything else. I think I hand it off.
You mentioned Chinky's work out in the Grassy's Bill.
Yes. I forgot to put that. Did I put Mars on there?
Grassy Mountain Radio Tower.
I didn't write Mars. I had it on my note. So yeah, out of Grassy Mountains, Tom Chidsey and a few others, the guys from NASA, have been doing Mars rover training.
Yeah.
Out there.
Cool.
With Mars, you know, the rover Jupiter to teach the drivers what the terrain might be like. Am I getting that right?
No, actually, so what these studies have been are kind of research protocol tests. So how are they going to route the rover around on Mars? Is it going to be a set traverse that they do? Or depending on what they find in one place, does that drive the decision on where to send the rover next? That kind of thing. So Chizzy's been involved with, I don't know if any of you know, Rebecca Williams.
Yeah, Davey's daughter.
Davey's daughter that Tom works a lot with. She's one of the rover drivers. And so what they're really focusing in on now are biomarkers. And so out in the grassies, there's some really good, carbonates and things that they can basically test the observation and results and then the decision-making that comes from that on where to go next. So they're heading out in just a couple weeks, I think, out to the grassies. So anyway, Tom offered to come out if we were interested in that as a stop on the board trip and kind of go over what they've been doing.
That'd be very interesting.
Seems cool. So you might get some wetlands, you might get some lithium.
One other thought is this is the first time we've ventured out into extension land big time. I mean, I guess we have. Coming from Cedar City, kind of on the edge of it. But right now, with all these we're in the Basin Range kind of province here, and maybe we should have an overview of the structure of that.
And that's what Don will do.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that was the intent with Don. Okay. And the original itinerary we got from Don, it says Don Clark, structure overview, Andrew Minerals. I just shortened it to put it on the slide. Yeah, we would love that. That'd be a good topic. Okay. I think I already mentioned this, but we did get $100,000. We are in the process of getting through HR all the right documents and forms and approvals to begin looking to hire someone in July when the new fiscal year kicks in. But the paperwork's already been started. And Marshall is leading the cause for that.
So how do you handle the shortfall from your request to what you got? Delay the hiring a couple months, or come up with the money from someplace else, or pay less? I mean, I don't know.
Probably pay a little less.
Yeah. Okay.
When he came to me, I ran some numbers, and what he was proposing, this is, an hourly fit within, we got it to fit within that budget. So delaying it doesn't fix the long-term problem.
Yeah. So gives you another chance to go back next year and hope you get the analysts convinced.
And something else we kicked around a little bit, at least in my mind, and I mentioned to them, is if you want a higher-level person, you can get people with different skill levels that require different hourly rates. We may not go through anything, but you could conceivably, if you find the right person, say, it may be someone that only wants to work three-quarter time. Mm. So you can pay them a higher rate, but they work a little less time, and they may actually be more effective than a lower rate person. And that might be a way to do it as well.
Okay, good.
So just something, because sometimes the right person walks in, and you go, this is the person we want, and you realize that the price, sometimes there's ways to work around it. So I think we can get there, though. So I'm going to turn it over to Jody, go ahead. Question. Go.
Yeah, looking at the agenda, we're at break time, and we're kind of off the schedule a little bit. It looks to me, but I need to take a break. Is it 10 o'clock?
It's 5 till.
Five till.
Yeah. Let's be back at 10. Get back on.
Take a short break.
A
okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Good call.
I'm a good man to speak, so it's probably been here 30 years, because
Okay. All right, everybody's here. It's time to listen to Jody on the financial report.
All right. This is the summary of our current report that I call our budget actual forecast, because it includes our budget and our year-to-date actuals and our forecast. Just wanted to highlight, we're currently forecasting about a $500,000 surplus that will be carried forward into next fiscal year. We did bring in about $121,000 from last fiscal year, so we're not dipping, you know, into that too much. And then our mineral lease, we bumped up this last month just a little bit, so we are now forecasting at about $1.5 million. I will note that this, if you compare this to the mineral lease report that's also included in the packet, this year-to-date mineral lease amount was only through February. Sometimes I'm off a week from when I get the data. So this is for February. However, in your packet, I show the amount through March. We're at about a little over $1.1 million through March. Our outside funding, which makes up, you know, dedicated credits and federal funds, so this amount here, this represents, year-to-date represents February's actuals, and it's about 56% of what's budgeted. However, billed is about 69% of actuals. So we're about in line with our expenditures, which, down here, our combined expenditures, I split this up between state-funded and grant-funded, and you can see we're at about 67%. So our revenue on our...
Can you make that just a little bit bigger?
Yeah.
Got old man eyes in the back of the room.
Yeah, so this is the combined expenditure percentage to date of our state-funded amounts and our grant-funded amounts. So that's in line with our revenue bill to date, although our revenue, let me go back up here and scroll out a little bit. Our revenue bill to date is lagging just a little bit behind our budget. So March represents about 75% of the year. Our billed amount is about 69%, so not too far behind. We're going to be wrapping up our spring and summer, you know, field season, so some of that grant revenue is weather dependent. So we've had a long winter, but I understand that they're going to get back out there and we'll get back on track. I think that's really all I wanted to mention on the forecast. Any questions on that? And then let's see. Yeah, so that was just. And then, also we're going into bills first. Okay. So on our legislative update, I'll talk about some bills that, kind of the budget related bills, and then Mike will talk about some other bills of interest. This was interesting. This Senate Bill 220. It's kind of redefining definitions for certain revenue types, and particularly dedicated credits. So dedicated credits are different from federal funds. Federal funds are grants directly from a federal agency. Dedicated credits are other grant revenue that's non-federal revenue. A lot of times it's grants or contracts for services. It's our fee revenue. But they're really trying to come up with some clear definitions on that, because budgetary statute has a little rule in there that limits you, or has limited us to only spending 125% of our appropriated dedicated credits. And that's been difficult for us because of, you know, a lot of times our grant awards come in at different times, and then at the time I do the budget request, we don't know what we're getting. And so you would have to play this game of estimating really high and plugging some fluff into your budget. You may or may not get that a grant. And so this really helps. What they've done is they've added a new term called expendable receipts. And so those would be excluded from that that limit. So, and what it, how it defines that is, it includes grants. So expendable receipts would be grants, and then also it could include state match for federal funds by, paid by a non-state entity. It also includes rebates, pharmacy rebates, and other things. But so that would be a good thing for us. Right now, the issue we're having is how it was appropriated during this last session. This bill actually came through at the last minute. And so last session, there was H. Bill 475, which kind of took a step towards this, and they called it contract revenue. And so they were saying, we're going to exclude contract revenue from that limitation. And that's how they built it into budget prep. And but now I'm kind of having to justify with Yvonne that these were truly, the certain amount of funding was truly expendable receipts and should be defined as that. So you may see when we go through the session this next year, I'll have to do a supplemental to redefine, because right now they have appropriated it all as dedicated credits. And I'm like, no, part of that, probably about two-thirds of that is really expendable receipts, but I don't want to be restricted to that limitation on. So just FYI on that. Then this one we've seen before, too. It actually passed this year. It's a joint resolution on budgeting provisions. It basically takes a percent of the budget each year and ask the committees to do a deep dive, and you've heard of the term zero-based budgeting, so they'll basically like you to start from scratch and justify your budget, build your budget. How it's worded, you know, 20% of its budget, so this is saying they want the appropriation subcommittee to take 20% of its budget each interim and analyze, you know, do this deep dive. So how they will approach that, if they'll take one department each year, or they'll take one division each year, we don't know.
What do they do when all your, when your entire budget is personnel costs?
Well, they may look, you know, I would assume, we've been through this, I've been through this before back in the early 2000s with another agency, and they basically, they look at your statute as well, and that's kind of, this is what we're statutorily set up to do. How much does that cost? And then just kind of build it from there. And so it'll be interesting to see how that comes about. Whoops, wrong direction.
Do you have any concerns about it at all?
I don't. You know, I have been through that process before, what we call a zero-based budgeting process before. And, yeah, and we're a really lean division already. I think we will need to have some teaching opportunities to explain how a lot of our current expense and travel money are tied to grants. So that's one area of our budget that I think will need to be explained. But other than that, budgetarily, we got an increase for compensation, mostly, you know, 2.5% salary and some health benefit increases, some other minor changes. What that meant for us is we got of that funding, they only fund the general fund piece of that increase, and so for us, we're about 60-40 split. So that $83,000 is money that we have to come up with, either through mineral lease or, you know, contract revenue. So what they do is they take your appropriation budget and they say, how much are you funded with general funds, mineral lease, dedicated credits? And then that's how they fund the compensation increase. So I look at that as a hit to our budget. I mean, that's a decrease to our budget, because that's extra money we need to come up with.
It's legislated.
Yeah, but it's, yeah.
We're obligated. We can't walk away from it.
Yeah, exactly. So This is the supplemental bill. It includes both the current fiscal year 19, and fiscal year 20. The top few bullets are fiscal year 19. Do you want to talk more about the salt flats? I think you have a little bit more history with.
So during the legislature, I'm trying to remember the Senator Handy.
Yeah.
Representative Handy, right?
Stephen Handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Representative Handy came, the racers, the people that race on the salt flats, came to him and says, look, we need to find a way to get the salt flats rebuilt. So we have not been able to race out there for the last couple of years. And so there's been a project with the mining company out there to take the salt. You know, they mine it and get, the potassium out. And then they've been taking some of the salt and spreading it back out in a slurry on the flats. And there's been some debate, you know, whether it does any good or not. They seem to think that it will. And so they presented before the finance committee, says, look, if you'll give us $5 million, we can get $45 million from the BLM to do this. And then during the Q&A, they asked them, where in the state are you going to park the $5 million? And they said, Utah Geological Survey. And it was the first time I'd heard of it. It was the first time many of us had heard of it. You know?
Better than telling them they're going to take it from you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, talk to Doggin this year. They took $1 million out of theirs. So the state, in the end, gave it to us, this $5 million. But it's contingent upon the other $45 million coming. And so we've spoken, you know, Mike Vandenberg has spoken with the lobbyist for that group, Tim Stevens, I think is his name, and he says he's working on it. He's not working on it with the local BLM. He's trying to run it out of D.C. So we don't know if it'll happen. If it does happen, you know, our folks' position is we don't want the money unless we can do some science with it. On the other hand, when they spoke with Styler about it, he says, well, we'll take at least some administration fees out of it. And I said, well, I'll take 10%.
Well, and Brian Steed might have some influence on that.
Yeah, he might have some influence on that. And so,
and there's some science involved in this, because as you said, nobody knows if this if this is going to work or not.
Yeah, and
so there'll be measurement opportunities and all kinds of things.
So Brandon Bowen up at the U has been working on
it. Right, I've gone to a talk.
And so whatever we do, if the money does come, we will carve out, and Mike Vandenberg and I, we talked, we said, just, this is your opportunity to find what science you want to do.
Yeah.
We don't have to have them tell us. We can pick and choose what we want to do and how it's related. And then if the money comes, we'll have it. But we don't know if it's... I mean, that'd be over 50% of my budget. $5 million.
Yeah,
most of it would be passed.
Don't get used to it.
No, I'm not. After talking about stabilization, right?
Yeah.
So does that give you a good background there? We don't know if it'll happen, how much when...
Yeah, and there's non-lapsing intent language with the meaning it will just roll over until something potentially happens.
So have they put the $5 million in the GS's account?
Not at this point, no.
Yeah. When is that? Until July 1st anyway, right? At the earliest?
This is his current fiscal year.
So okay.
Yeah.
Nothing will happen until that 45.
That'll trigger it. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. The other piece is this $481,000 for dedicated credits. I had to do a quasi-building block, and that goes back to the whole dedicated credits, contract revenue, expendable receipt debate, so that I could have authority to spend additional grant money that has come in since the fiscal year 19 appropriation. Also within this bill, it talks about our non-lapse intent language. It's currently set for $600,000 for this year. As I previously noted, we're estimating about $500,000, so that's a good place to be. You want it to be close, but you don't want to go over, because if you go over that, you only have authority up to the $600,000, so you would have to lapse anything above that. And then in fiscal year 20, we mentioned the $100,000 for the new data coordinator position. And then again, I built in some additional fundings for our contract
So the data coordinator position is, I don't remember that discussion. What tell me.
The new database manager, the 100,000.
Here
in our mm-hmm. gut.
Okay.
For a new position.
Okay.
To free up people who are primarily, should be doing geological work.
Okay.
To have somebody do IT so work. For
essentially, us. Database manager, IT specialist kind
right.
of person. Okay. All right. GIS person, partially.
You know, managing all the data that informs our interactive maps.
They'll be the behind-the-scenes person.
But they'll know that technology, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We would hope so.
Well, I've seen the Forest Service, I've seen a split, which gets weird.
Can't afford that.
Yeah, we're not nice. We don't have that luxury yet.
Yeah,
so the Senate Bill 5 is our base budget bill, and you know the other bills, the supplementals add to that. Do you mind if I just jump ahead to the other budget piece, and then we'll circle back? I think it'll make a little more.
I don't have a budget piece.
Oh, you didn't have the...
Did I miss something? Go back.
Oh, okay.
Maybe you skipped over it earlier.
No. It's in your packet. It was just kind of summarizing, pulling this together for fiscal year 20 appropriated budget. It just kind of had the...
So this was it a highlight in yellow? Is that you mean?
No.
All that, okay, yeah.
So
we
it
didn't
shows
get,
the base budget. It
shows, $8.4 million?
Yeah, exactly.
That's in your packet.
Yes, in your packet.
Third page of the director's report.
Yeah. So it just shows the kind of the combined appropriated budget, which is the base budget of about $7.8 million, the additional $300,000 for the additional mm-hmm. revenue, the data coordinator, the compensation piece. And I just wanted to note that it is appropriated at $8.4 million. However, in that is just the appropriation budget. You know, in August, after we close out, we'll do what we call our operating budget. So we know we're already going to be down a little bit. Because within this budget, we were estimating $1.6 million in mineral lease. Vandenberg is now estimating about $1.3 million. So we're already down about $300,000 there. I mentioned the compensation, how we have to come up with an additional $83,000. The non-lapse, it assumes $600,000 of the non-lapse, but we're only estimating about $500,000. So I just kind of wanted to point out some of those, although this is an appropriated amount, it looks like, you know, it looks fine, however, it doesn't account for some of these other amounts that are actually below what was appropriated, and it doesn't give us any room for equipment maintenance or replacement. It doesn't give us any room for staff increases or adjustments, promotions,
software license renewals,
any other unplanned things. It doesn't allow us to have estimating in a non-lapse for next year. You know that cushion that we mm-hmm. typically have. So I'd be really interested to see where our operating budget kind of falls into place, and we may be wanting to consider some building blocks, some special time building blocks for equipment or in addition to the mineral lease issue.
So Jody, if we, let's say that we convince the legislature to fund the survey, and we mm-hmm. gave up the mineral lease money and the LEDA money, for that matter. It's not very much anymore.
Yeah.
So would you still need to have this $600,000 or so savings account?
No, that typically has been used to ride the wave of mineral lease
right.
and contract revenue or federal funds outside revenue. So our outside revenue, you know, our dedicated credits, we're now expendable receipts, and federal funds, those do fluctuate a little bit. You might remember the days of them being up around $2 million. They're now about $1.7 or $6 million. You know, those opportunities aren't out there as much.
So you maybe need to hang on to half of it or something like that?
We'll still need a little bit of a cushion, yeah, to ride those unexpected And the timing of those is difficult to manage as well. So yeah, I would still want $200,000 to $300,000 in there just.
Well, I mean, that's an argument, though, with the legislative analyst, because I know that those keeping a pile of money that is just being a savings account drives them nuts.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts,
too. They took $1 million out of
Out of dog, sure. Yep.
And, and they felt like they got beat up for being prudent and wise stewards.
Yeah, so it's, we still have some volatility in our budget, so we still need to... And like Bill was saying, and his big idea on the funding, the stabilizing that is, when we get so tight and we have to ride this roller coaster, we have no room for these other things that we really need to, give some money to and attention to.
One of the things that I think is an important driver is it's stressful for the staff to go through this constantly. And I think that ought to be the part of the story. I mean,
for sure.
People's lives and livelihood are incredibly important, and the value they add to the state is overwhelming, and they need to be recognized for that.
I'd put it a slightly different way. We get some incredibly valuable people here who have already decided they would rather work for a stable agency than to ride the roller coaster that is working in the oil and gas business or the mining business or a lot of other businesses. So we're getting a discount because we're not paying them as well as we would if they were if we were an oil company. And so we shouldn't impose that stress that you're talking about on them because we've already made a deal with them. We're just not holding up our end of it.
Yeah.
That's the way I would put it.
Yeah. So I'm going to, can I ask a quick question here then? As we go forward, I think it would be useful if we had a statement from the board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like some sort of official, you know, as we work this out.
I hope will come out of August.
Yes, that you guys would give us an official, that you'd say, we want you to take this to the legislature, or you send it to the legislature. Says,
A directive. And I would like at this meeting in August to have each board member think about how they feel about all this ahead of time and go around the room and hear what everybody thinks.
That'd be a good takeaway to have with us.
Yeah.
As we think about that. Okay. Thanks. Sorry, I didn't have that page in. I'm not sure why.
Oh, that's okay.
I missed it.
So now are we moving back to Mike?
Yeah, he has some additional bills.
Right.
Adventures, I think.
Yeah, there were about a half a dozen or so that we just kind of watched through the session out of interest. They don't really, most of them don't directly affect us, but there could be some indirect effect. So that House Bill 14 is kind of an interesting one, State Monuments Act amendments. This, the amendments that were incorporated into this act, which sets up the opportunity for the state to establish state monuments, similar to a federal monument, but under state control. A lot of what was behind, at least part of this, is the situation down at Dalton Wells, north of Moab, where we have a very important dinosaur quarry, and there is dispersed camping that takes place in that area that's just gotten really out of control. And there's potential for vandalism in the quarry. So initially there was some talk about a bill to establish a Dalton Wells State Park, but that didn't go anywhere. So what one of the amendments does in this HB 14 is it provides for some entity other than state parks to manage these state monuments. And there was behind the scenes discussion with I forget his name. His son was the kid who pushed for establishing Utah Raptor as the state dinosaur last year.
Johnson.
His father is a well-funded proponent of basically the UGS managing.
Yeah, which we should not do.
But yeah.
That's not our business.
Right. That's way outside, you know, the scope of our what we're set up to do, you know, in code. So anyway, that's just one that we'll just kind of continue to keep an eye on it and be in discussion with the state parks folks and forestry, fire, and state lands. They have land in that area.
I'm hopeful that before the legislative session, I got a call from Rick, can't remember who, warning me that this guy was going to call. Mm-hmm. And press us to take that over. Yeah. And so I was prepared to talk to him about it, and he never called, so I'm hopeful that maybe somebody else got the message to him.
Okay.
But
yeah, we haven't had any calls.
But that's State Parks.
Jeremy Roberts.
Roberts, yeah. That's right. Yeah. And but that should be either State Parks or it should be Grand County, but it damn sure should be us.
All right. Let's see, there are a couple of bills that affect some provisions and professional occupational licensing, including one that maybe might work in Bill's favor, where instead of a time-based requirement of, you know, functioning at a high level as a geologist to qualify you for getting a Utah PG, you can substitute a competency-based requirement instead of that time-based. And so with Bill's situation,
So just to give you my background, I have a professional license from Texas, which I've had since 2003. So that's, what, 16 years. Licensed, you know, professional geologist.
Do we not recognize that?
They won't recognize it unless I've been licensed by that state for 20 years. And they didn't start licensing until 2003.
Oh, silly.
They want me to go take the exams.
Part of the reason is if you have a grandfathered license in one state, you can't use that for reciprocity in another state.
Unless you've been licensed for 20 years.
Yes.
And I've been licensed for 16. Yeah, close. So I may, in October or wherever it is, be taking the federal exams, the national exams, unless this bill helps me out.
Yeah, so that's that one there, 226. Then HB 387 actually had a few things that affect UGS and also affects this body here, the board.
Should I need to go to
this bill? Sure, yeah. You see that first bullet there, it says requires executive branch board to submit an annual report to the governor's office. So this is a new requirement. In looking at it, it doesn't look like it's going to take a lot of effort and will largely fall.
Well, you just slow down, it's really hard to read that.
Page 110.
You are right on it.
I know where I need to be.
She was reading all of it. Come on. What line number?
Starting down there on 5A.
No, give me the number on that.
2961. So before August 1st of each year, each board shall prepare and submit to the administrator, who's in the governor's office, annual report that includes name of the board, description of the board's function, purpose, so some boilerplate stuff there. But then a description of the actual work performed by the board since the last report, blah, 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 which I think we can, you know, summarize from our action items in our meeting summaries.
Sure.
Let's see, description of actions taken by the executive board since the last report. Da, 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 da. So, you know,
and whether you should
a
continue
quick summary of, we met so many times during the year. We made these decisions in the meeting, so fairly straightforward. Yeah, I like the one at the end there.
Yeah.
The indication of whether the executive board should continue to exist.
You know, there are probably some that shouldn't.
Well, and that's
the point.
The whole purpose of this bill, is, you know, there's some 400 boards and commissions that they're looking at sunset reviews for. You know, do we still need this entity or not? So, anyway, just wanted you all to be aware of this requirement, and we'll be
working with you to put together that report, have you all, you know, take a look at it before anything is submitted to the administrator. So starting this year.
Things change with time. I grew up in a town in New Hampshire where there's still a law in the books that says that a motorized vehicle needs to be preceded by a person carrying a lantern.
Cool.
And we still elect a hog reeve at town meeting every year.
A hog reeve?
A hog reeve. That's a person who settles disputes between people who each claim to own the same pig.
Such yeah. Blue laws, we call them.
Such as New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's it.
It's not just New Hampshire, but
okay.
So the second bullet there deals with the end of the LEADA funding. I believe that was a 10-year period of time there for our groundwater monitoring out in the West Desert. And yeah, as Mark mentioned, and I think Jody touched on it too, you know, that the level of that funding has decreased a lot over those 10 years, partly because of restructuring of that section of code there and what our percentage comes out of after they lop $1 million or right off the top.
Right.
To us, Constitutional Defense Fund, I think, gets that money.
So what's your plan? This was brought to me earlier this week by the Associate Director of CITLA. Who asked me if I knew about it, and I said, well, I know it exists, but I really don't. And then I called Bill yesterday, I guess, and asked him about it, and he said, yeah, we're all over it, don't worry about it. So are we going to ask to have it extended?
I wrote up a very short note about we have ongoing hydrologic studies in Snake Valley, and I would, if it were directed to groundwater, I would use it as matching funds for some continuing projects we have in mind.
So you're going to ask for a 10-year extension?
I didn't have a time frame.
They didn't ask a time frame. About those details, I guess, yet. What is it, about 2 weeks out?
It's the 15th,
May 15th. Yeah.
It's been 11,500 the last couple fiscal years. So it's not, you know.
Well, it's very between 10 to 5,000, depending on what they do with the fourth quarter money.
Oh.
But, it's so, very minimal. But I mean,
we'll take it.
I mean, our budget is scrutinized at that level of.
It's going to
smaller amounts, so I've.
It's going to have the same trajectory as mineral lease money does, largely because it's coming from the same source.
Yeah.
But it's still free money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we ought to ask for a 10-year extension.
Yeah, it's probably not that hard of a fight.
Yeah, I guess, are you going to go to the hearing?
I'll be there. Jody will probably be there.
If you want Stefan to go, if you want somebody, a Snake Valley person to go, he or Paul can probably go.
As that equipment ages, it's going to start.
It's going to, yeah.
We've been dealing with that. But yes.
Does this play at all into our concerns for water grabs from adjacent states?
That's true. That was the driving force.
So we might want to reiterate that.
In the expedition.
I noted without going into detail that that is still out there.
Yeah, we need to buy that cannon to shoot it.
we would the meeting. You know, we've been contacted by the legislative office, Brian Allred, and Christine. I can't remember her last name.
Tricia Owen.
Huh? Trisha Olin, who's the legislative analyst.
Yeah, those two. I've spoken with both of them. But Hugh's going to be out of town, and I'm going to be out of town, so Hugh's getting Mike up to speed and make sure that we're well represented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say let's go for an extension. And the reason is that if we just get the money, it's money we wouldn't have had otherwise. But also, if we get to the point where we're negotiating with a legislative group over trying to adjust where our funding comes from, it's another thing we could give up as part of that deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, and then the last thing on there was the Utah Seismic Safety Commission was one of the commissions identified for a sunset date in 2025.
It's because we've been waiting for this earthquake.
Where is it? So as that review process takes place, you know, we'll be, you know, Steve is on the board of that commission, and you know we're talking with the other commission members, and you know we'll make our case.
In listening to the hearing that the legislature had, one of the concerns from the sponsor was the being a part-time legislature, that the members are having to serve on so many of these boards and commissions, and like for USSC, they never show up. Mm-hmm. And so they're getting spread quite thin, and so that was part of the concern, you know, maybe either pull them off, or maybe these boards, certain ones don't need to exist, because there were some on there that were created in the past, and their mission has now gone away, and so, but they're still in the books, kind of like those laws that you had.
Yep.
And so that was a kind of a cleanup bill. You know, when I listened,
who's the sponsor?
I can't remember.
That is Notwell.
Notwell, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem like that they were hostile or anything to any of these boards. It was just kind of more of a cleanup process.
And I would suggest that the sponsor of that bill doesn't really want to be quoted after a 7-magnitude earthquake knocks down a bunch of unreinforced masonry houses in Salt Lake City. Right. And that ought to be reason enough not to do that.
And I exchanged an email with the general counsel on this.
Did you?
Beforehand. Saying, you know, we really want this commission to stick around.
Yeah.
And he said, the governor's not here to get rid of boards that, I'm paraphrasing a little here, but we're not here to get rid of things we need, but he just thinks it's good governance to have it reviewed periodically.
So is this,
and that's kind of the, what I walked away with on that.
And that's the same thing that all of us have received.
So.
But this says sunset, so would that be a review in 2025? Or would that
be a year before?
The review would be before that.
Okay, because if there isn't a bill to continue with, it would be terminated.
See, the original legislation says this commission will cease to exist on such and such a date.
I see.
And so we'll just review that and say, no, you want you guys to re-up it.
I have a question for Mike. There's a bill here that, under the licensing, provides allowance for criminal record to not disqualify a licensed applicant if all other licensing requirements are met. Is that for felony convictions or is it for misdemeanors?
I don't think it's.
I wouldn't think it's. Do you know anything about that?
I believe it's quite broad, but it does. I can remember it requires the DOPL director to make that decision because the licensing boards in Utah are advisory only, and so we're not. We don't actually make the legal decision on whether to rescind somebody's license or take an action. We make a recommendation, and the DOPL director actually makes the legal decision. And the reason that, because of that, there was some issues that I believe back in South Carolina where the dentistry board was trying to prevent teeth cleaning or something.
Oh.
And that board was the official legal entity, and the Supreme Court found constitutional issues. And so because of the way it's set up here, the DOPL director actually makes those decisions. It's kind of a complicated legal thing.
So you can't be licensed here if you're a convicted felon, can you?
Not currently.
It should stay that way.
But this might... But I mean, what type of, you're talking about like an electrician license?
No, I'm talking about a registered professional engineer or a registered geologist.
The only case that we have had come forward, a gentleman committed a sex crime, which was a felony, and his license was suspended for a period of time while he went through therapy in the prison time. And then he committed a second felony after he got out, which was not geology or professional related, but it was a fiduciary issue. And at that point, the board unanimously recommended to have his license terminated and revoked. And the DOPL director agreed and did that. But that's the only case that's come before.
Well, the reason I ask is that I've been involved some years ago in a case where somebody who is an oil and gas operator in the state of Utah represented himself as a registered professional engineer in front of the DOGM board, and I know that he was a convicted felon who served time on issues that had to do with the industry. And so I researched it back then, and I just tried to figure it out from looking at the statute. I couldn't figure it out here, but he wasn't registered here. And I looked in Texas, and you can't be a registered professional engineer in Texas if you've got a felony conviction.
I believe here the applicant has to come in front of the board.
Yeah.
their case, and then the board would have to make a recommendation to the DAVL director of either approving or denying the license.
I can think of a case like someone who has a felony from another state for a small amount of marijuana back in the day, and then we were really hammering.
Yeah. And that is something that the applicant would have to acknowledge in the application. It's part of that. You have to answer if you had any criminal convictions. And there's also a multi-state organization that transfers that information. So if you have a conviction or you end up having a citation under your license, other states know about it.
As long as somebody gets to make a decision on it, I think most of us can agree that some people shouldn't be licensed anymore.
Yeah. Since I've been on the board, we have not had any of that
going
forward, and I don't believe prior to that they had either.
Good. Thank you.
And so then the last three bills and resolutions on the list were just basically in support of renewable energy development, that sort of thing, opening up a door possibly to some support of K-12 energy education things that our GIO program might be able to benefit from. The last one, that Senate Concurrent Resolution 8, Mark alluded to earlier today, talking about that LNG export facility on the Oregon coast, and this is kind of meant to give some momentum to that effort. So that's it on the bills.
Thank you. Any other discussion on this? Okay, we're on to the discussion of the Crawford Award.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's meant you were to take the break. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what let's do. Let's put the Crawford Award at the end of the session so that we can deal with the Forge project and the geohazards efforts and not
We had Stephanie
not make these guys go away and come back.
Yeah. Just one slide for you on the Forge, since Stefan's not here. Anybody not familiar with the Forge project? You're not familiar?
I'm familiar.
You're familiar? Okay, anybody know? I just want to show they've got the three wells drilled, and if you hit the page down button three times, there you go. There's my animation. So they drilled the first well to 7536. Then they drilled a 1,000-foot well, and then they put the 3,300-foot well in. They did that, finished that this spring. They put seismometers down, and they got a DAS cable, which is a fiber optic, down the borehole. Mm-hmm. And they did a stimulation test last week in the deep hole, the 7536, and they were able to see all the response of the microseismicity in the 3,300-foot hole, and they could actually map the boundary between the crust or the granite and the basin fill. And they've mapped it very distinctly, and everything seems to be working really well.
So they're getting ready to do their frack?
Yeah.
And this matters to us because this is a $140 million project in which we have a stake, and the award was made to EIG or EGS. And instead of being a clean award where they awarded the whole amount, they awarded $10 million because they said, we're not convinced you can frack that crystalline rock. So here's $10 million to go do that with, and if you pull that off, then you get the rest of the money. So
they said $10 million last year, $10 million this year, and then we're up.
Yeah,
that's right. And their review will be in mid-July. And so, but, and the 3301, they actually got, as it turned out to be a really good water well. So they want to have to be buying water and piping it from Milford. So I was actually out on the well site when they're drilling the 3300, and they were down at 3280, and the water coming over the shaker was just steaming. You can see the steam coming off. So they had really good temperature. So, but our folks have been out there helping them decide where to drill these two ancillary wells. They've done gravity work, and they're going to be doing continued gravity. This picture was taken with our drone. And they flew the drone out there. And so, anyway, doing some good work out there. I thought I'd give you the quick update, Dave.
Thank you.
We also have a ground deprivation network out there.
Yeah. Okay. So now it's Hugh.
All right.
Thanks.
Oh, that was a great picture from the drone.
Get it?
Did you want me to help?
We all were, we were all there last September.
Okay. Set up. So,
I was there last week.
You know, on tomorrow, I'm giving a talk to the RDCC, but I'm wondering. Let's see here.
What are you looking for?
Looking
for your Google Drive or
that?
There it is.
It's going to be just a Snake Valley overview. But I was wondering, I threw a couple other things in this morning. I was wondering if maybe just a simpler program groundwater update, and some of it pertains to what we've been talking about.
It's up to you. You can take the direction.
Try it out. And it makes me nervous because I haven't really thought this out that carefully. But. I talked to you all in January.
Why'd you go with full screen mode anyway?
Oh yeah.
Well,
that's F5, right?
Yeah.
Or not.
Lower right hand corner. Go left. 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 Right. Back. There you go. There you go. Thanks.
How we're kind of in a transition period that's exciting in a lot of ways and difficult in others, in that we spent a lot of this fiscal year wrapping up kind of backlog reports and recently finished projects. So there's been a lot of report writing, and we're actually doing really well with that. They'll be coming through.
I'm already seeing them.
Which means that for next fiscal year, we can start to look for new projects and kind of think more about what we're doing and how it fits in to what the state needs. So this is just a compiled list. I realize it's hard to read because I just threw it together, but of projects we've submitted, and this is in addition to ongoing projects. So the biggest is the hydrologic monitoring of pinyon juniper treatments to the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative. There's also a companion proposal to the Division of Water Quality's non-point source program for that. There's several smaller proposals to the BLM and the Endangered Species Mitigation Fund, mainly by the Wetland Program. And possibly, a septic tank density study in the Bryce Canyon City area. That is an add-on to our ongoing geologic framework study there. they just submitted a one-year proposal to look at the groundwater levels surrounding Great Salt Lake as a continuation of the chemical framework of groundwater around Great Salt Lake. That's one thing we might throw out, that I wanted to throw out in a little bit in terms of this thinking big and how to fund things. We think Great Salt Lake is going to be a really key issue for the state going on, and we probably fill an important niche in terms of looking at the actual groundwater contributions and how important they are. So the total for outside funding, in addition to what we already have, is $290,000. We don't know if we'll get all of this, but things have been going well. And we have two other in preparation. So we have a lot of projects, the kind of new projects that we're looking at, and a lot of different sources of funding, a lot of different codes for Jody to follow. And a lot of this is in response to, all of this is in response to what our colleagues want and need to have studied, and calls for proposals that are put out there. And that's a big way that we work, the groundwater program. Let's see. Before I move on, I'll just mention these are the wetland, the predominantly wetland program grants are comparatively small, 24, 28, 6,000 of outside funding. However, Diane already has two very large EPA program development grants in place that cover the next 2.5 fiscal years, and that's something like a total of $400,000. And in fact, I recently compiled just from the operating budgets from, I think it started in the ones I had access to, so maybe FY17 on, wetland grants have totaled $2.1 million in projects and $1.7 million of outside funding. So they have, their buildings are really substantial track record. It's very impressive. And it shows, and they all are also, you know, part of Diane's job is to, as the state wetlands coordinator, is to communicate to all the other agencies that manage and have interests in wetlands and related lands, and see what they need done. And so the fact that they've continued that support shows they're very good at bringing together all the different elements and responding really well to what they need and producing really, you know, excellent science. So this is just to note that in addition to these one-by-one-year grants that we're looking at with forestry, fire, and state lands, I've encouraged Stefan and Paul to think about a five-year work plan. Like, where is this all headed? And they've actually been working with Elliot and Andrew in the energy and minerals section, because they have expertise in kind of more of the salt deposit end of things. So we're cooking something up big, I hope, that, or a long-term project. We don't know the funding. We're focusing on the science and what really needs to be known that will support kind of the Great Salt Lake environment. This is just a block diagram that Stefan made to show that, you know, most of the focus and input to Great Salt Lake is through surface water, and that's where most of the science has been. But there are also, there's also groundwater flux into Great Salt Lake. It's more diffuse, and so it's harder to track. But we don't know very well the role in terms of volume and salt load that this provides, and how it might buffer high salt input, or in places increase the salinity of the lake. For example, if there's geothermal brines coming up along fault zones. So they are, that's kind of what we want to look at in for big, you know, for the future. And we're just sort of designing the study. And so that's something I know Mike Styler's expressed interest in, but, you know, at some point when we're ready, we can talk about how to move forward with it.
Be great.
And, yeah.
I think there was a resolution this year that to keep the Great Salt Lake, what was it, 2 feet?
Yeah. So
it's already risen 2 feet since the first of the year.
Pretty timely.
The lake has risen 2 feet, and they want to keep it there.
Yeah. And there's
how they're going to do that, I don't know. But there was a resolution.
Shot with God.
Yeah, the legislators, they didn't make it so.
And a really key component is the wetlands fringing the Great Salt Lake, because not only are they migratory bird habitat, conservation species habitat. They're there for recreation. They also provide a physical and chemical buffer to all that junk we put in the aquifer here, and that flows out to Great Salt Lake. The Wetland Group has recently completed their map of wetlands surrounding Great Salt Lake. And I don't know if that's on the website yet or not, but it's done. So
when you do that, does that new mapping go to Fish and Wildlife Service to update their wetlands
yes,
map?
Yes, it's okay. All compatible with the NWI, National Wetland Inventory?
Yes.
Is that what it is? Yes. They are in very close communication with that and set it up, and they set up their database to match the NWI specifications. So that was like the last bit of review that wetland map had to go through, was that it, all the fields and all the details made it seamless with NWI. Yeah. So as I mentioned, we tend to have specific projects in specific areas for specific needs, which are all very good. That's been how it's been since I've been here, and I'm almost at 24 years. And it sustained the longevity and the growth of the groundwater program. One thing we have not tended to do are statewide programs where it's hard to identify, you know, like a specific agency that would want a specific result out of work, but would still be really valuable for the state. And so we're also starting to think about that kind of thing. I think my concept is sort of aquifers in Utah, which is a very old publication that Water Rights put out, but as a you know, user-driven web map and data download, so it would have all the key aquifers throughout the state. And changes in storage, changes in groundwater levels, physical extent, hydraulic properties, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty big project. But I'm just using our colleagues in New Mexico as an example, where they have several statewide projects where they're looking at changes in groundwater level and storage, classifying the aquifers throughout the state. And that's something they've done, and we actually kind of hold joint meetings with them occasionally and are talking a lot. So I'm going to talk to them about how they design these and move forward with them. But that's something we want to think about, too, that might benefit from this general fund, you know, shift to more general funds and maybe a little less dependence on getting external funds. So I think that's all I had for now. I mean,
that's good.
No, that's science. So we don't have to.
No, that's good. I think it's perfect.
Any response to that or advice or?
Keep going.
We have
voted yes twice yesterday.
We've hired a summer intern. Her name is Lydia Keenan. She's a graduate of University of Utah in Environmental Studies and Sustainability. Most of that will be wetland mapping work and various field assistance. I have a few projects in the pinyon juniper hydrologic monitoring that I think I could set up where they would be sort of a mini report, you know, that, you know, sort of give her a topic that she can research and come through. And it's at this point through August, but we certainly have enough work, intern level work, that people at higher pay rates are having to do right now. So that's another issue that I know you all touched on just now. But having the ability to have interns, you know, long term would be important and helpful in a lot of ways.
Yep.
There's a lot of great candidates from just within, you know, from Logan to
A lot of great ones and eager ones.
Right.
Are you doing anything with public education in terms of the importance of wetlands?
Yeah, she has worked on some of that.
I mean,
that's a major component of one of the projects Diane has been looking at. I'm not sure where that is.
I just recently had an experience in a stovepipe. I'm not going to specify, but in a stovepipe organization where one group of specialists understand this piece and one group of specialists understands this piece, and then they come down right on top of wetlands because there's nobody who understands the importance of wetlands. So it's not just kids, but if we get kids to understand, working it up, maybe when people become professionals, they'll consider wetlands.
Right. It's just on their radar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're good.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Hugh.
Steve.
Okay.
Do you need to...
You can just close yours.
Let me just exit out. I'll just get out. I'll just pull this before I forget.
And don't close mine. I got a thank you slide if you want. Your PowerPoint should be open, though. Go down to the bottom. There it is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oops. I was making it work.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm Steve Bowman.
Use the wheel to go backwards.
Oh, I know what it is. There's that button on the side.
Yeah.
Mouse is too smart.
Yeah.
That's one of those. So anyway, the hazards program, we pretty much So anyway, the hazards program, we're kind of focused in three different areas. One, we respond to geologic hazard emergencies, and we provide information to emergency managers and incident commanders to make informed decisions. So we don't take over an incident or anything like that. You know, if they have a landslide or something like that, a lot of questions come up, like, is it safe to send first responders onto this landslide? And so we'll give them our opinion of what, you know, what we think. Or later on, you know, the city is wondering, how do we deal with these issues? And so we'll end up providing advice, and then they get to make an informed decision and policy and all that and move forward. The other part is we investigate and map the hazards. The second map there, that's just a compilation of all of the known earthquakes and quaternary or hazardous faults in the state. And we usually do these mapping these geologic hazards in urban or rapidly developing areas, trying to get ahead of development so that planners and landowners and land purchasers and others have more information to make informed decisions. You know, like it had been mentioned earlier, you know, development's moving into these more hazardous areas, and if people aren't dealing with it, then we're having more and more problems. Landslides, cost to property owners, cost to the taxpayer. You know, we usually do that either with PDFs, you know, or a printed map like you see on the wall, and everything is now GIS spatial data as well, because a lot of the planning departments and developers, you know, consultants like Rick and others, they'd rather have the GIS data do their own analysis. And then the third kind of aspect is hazard-related, more technical and educational outreach on what these hazards are. Last week I was invited to the Six County Association of Governments. They're working on revising their hazard mitigation plans. And every 5 years, FEMA requires these plans to be updated. And the reason these plans exist, in order to get federal FEMA money, a local government has to have these plans in place. And they just provide information on what the hazards are and what are ways these local governments can help mitigate these hazards before actually having one. And then we also work on kind of the public side with this outreach. Last week, Bluffdale had a preparedness fair. We had two geologists there doing a presentation related to the earthquake sequence, and then also had a booth there getting information out. And everything's focused on reducing the life, safety, property, and economic risk for Utah, which is quite large. And then the picture here is Riverdale. About a year and a half ago, there was a landslide that started there at the bluff, and it's continued to enlarge, and I'll show you some pictures as we go along. And so in Utah, we have most of the geologic hazards that exist. Not all the hazards exist everywhere, and there are some hazards that people are generally unfamiliar with, like a tsunami hazard. There are hazardous faults underneath Utah, Great Salt Lake, and Bear Lake that if there was an earthquake and rupture of that fault, you could create a tsunami. How big, we don't know, but it's very unlikely to be anything of the size like you've seen in Indonesia. And then they kind of fall into these five categories of earthquake hazards and those varieties, landslides, flooding, and then this large category called problem soil and rock hazards. And these are generally non-life-threatening, with the exception of radon gas, which is actually Utah's largest killer, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And then Utah does have a small volcanic hazard, not necessarily from any volcanoes within the state, but volcanic ash that can be emanated from volcanoes, say, in the Cascades, California, or the Yellowstone Complex. And it only takes about a quarter of an inch of ash to completely shut down a community, including all the electrical service as well. What happens is the ash, when it gets on electrical insulators, will short them out and then the system's off. And if any of that ash gets into an engine, it's just like glass shards and it'll tear an engine up in seconds. And that's another reason why aircraft avoid volcanic ash clouds, because it was back in the 80s, a big jetliner coming from Asia over Alaska flew into one and all four engines quit, and at the very last minute, the one engine they were able to start.
Can't be good for lungs either, huh?
And yeah. Lungs as well, yes. Everybody's familiar with the Wasatch Fault Zone that runs from north of Malad City, Idaho, south to just north of Fayette. Mike over in the corner has been involved in a fair bit of mapping with our program down on the southern end of the Wasatch Fault Zone. And over 85% of the population lives along the fault, and over 75% of the economy of the states along the fault. And it's not just a Utah issue or a regional issue, it's really a continental problem having a major earthquake here, because there are three major interstates across the state, major railroad lines, one of the three major internet backbone lines that carries a substantial portion of the internet traffic in the U.S. travels through Salt Lake, east to west, and there's a variety of natural gas, petroleum, and water supply pipelines, and all of the gas and diesel and jet fuel from Utah comes from the refineries up north, along with almost all of Idaho. And so, you know, if there was a major earthquake along the fault, it's not just going to be a Salt Lake problem, it's really a U.S. problem.
We also send refined products to Las Vegas, I think, by pipeline.
That's correct.
Yeah. So.
And you don't think it crosses this fault.
It doesn't?
No.
And most of Las Vegas' natural gas supply also crosses the fault. There are two 36-inch high-pressure pipelines.
Kern River, yeah.
Which could have been taken out by a landslide. And so several years ago, there was a group put together, and Mike and I were on that, to look at the probabilities of what earthquakes were in the northern Utah and southern Idaho and Wyoming regions. And at that time, it was determined there would be a 57% probability in the next 50 years, which is actually higher since time's gone by, of a magnitude 6 or greater, which is greater than a 1 in 2 chance. And so a magnitude 6 earthquake, even though it doesn't sound that big, actually can cause substantial damage when in Utah we have the highest density of URM, these unreinforced masonry or brick structures. And there's also a variety of concrete tilt-up structures that were also built before modern building codes where they were strengthened. And even in the next 30 years at that time, there was 40%. And so it's a substantial amount. And the map on the left, it just shows you what these probabilities are. The darker colors in the red are higher probabilities, the lighter colors are lower probabilities. Several years ago, the Division of Emergency Management that we work with very frequently, they run a model called HAZES. It's a model developed by FEMA to look at, after an event like a flood, an earthquake, or a hurricane, what are the expected losses in terms of fatalities, injuries, and property loss. These numbers are actually quite low because there's been a rerun of the model that's going on right now. But at that time, say there was a major earthquake in Salt Lake City, which there's a scenario of shaking over here on the left, they estimated $42 billion of immediate losses in just buildings alone. And that's a substantial portion of the state's yearly GDP. And then of the 9,000 injuries and fatalities, about 4,000 to 3,000 of those are actual fatalities. And you know, one of the problems we have is there's a significant portion of the state that is built upon a fault, unfortunately. Back in February 2008, there was a magnitude 6 earthquake over in Wells, Nevada, just to the west of here. And it really is an analog for a lot of rural Utah. And so this was kind of the message last week with the six counties. You know, Wells is a small rural town. Their economies are quite susceptible to any kind of impacts. And as you can see here, there's a lot of URM buildings. You know, and that car that was parked there by the street there, had someone been on the passenger side, it would have at least been an injury and potentially a fatality just from these bricks coming off. And one of the issues with earthquakes is they're not covered by homeowners insurance, similar to floods, if you don't have an extra insurance policy. And as you know, we alluded to earlier, we also support the Utah Seismic Safety Commission. Along with the Division of Emergency Management, we provide staff support. And then by delegation from Bill, I also serve on the commission. Our kind of role is to maintain the USSC website, respond to more technical geologic questions, and then we support commission projects. And this is just the homepage for the commission, where there's a variety of publications that have been authored by the commission available to you. And then as part of working with a lot of these seismic hazards, one of the items that's in the UGS code is to designate what are called special study zones for earthquake hazards. And so what we've been doing is mapping in detail using LIDAR elevation data that you've probably seen before. At a scale of 1 to 10,000 where possible, or in some of the urban areas at 1 to 24,000, fault traces. And so the pane on the left shows you the Wasatch Fault Zone where we've mapped fault traces. And unfortunately, at this scale, you can't see all of the individual little traces very well. I'll show you a map in a minute, but kind of a blow up. And then the map on the right, we're starting mapping over in Cache Valley for the east and west cache fault zones. And there's a variety of other kind of unmapped faults in the center point of the valley. And this data is showing where these faults are located and then these special study zones, which are buffers around them, end up helping communities avoid building structures or infrastructure across these faults. And I'll show you some of the special study zones in a minute. And then these colored shaded areas, they're just different LIDAR acquisitions projects where we've collected LIDAR data either as direct funding to this work from the U.S. Geological Survey or as part of larger State of Utah projects where we bundle together funding. And I'll talk about that in a little bit too. And so the map on the left just shows you another project that will be starting later this year, actually next fiscal year, to map the east and west Bear Lake fault zones and the Boker and Topwood Hills fault zones over in Tooele County. And the map on the right, this just shows you the mapped fault traces using the LIDAR, field reconnaissance, aerial photography with the red lines. And then the red shaded area, those are the buffer zones where, as part of guidelines that I'll show you in a little bit, we recommend that special studies be done before construction where a consultant like Rick's company or others would go out, dig a trench, and make sure that the fault isn't going to be where the building footprint is. Because even at a scale of 1 to 10,000, when you're looking at a lot, you know, there's still a significant amount of error where that line could be at that scale. And there may be some other small faults that we didn't map that could be picked up in those trenches. And so, being not regulatory, these are recommended, but there are quite a few communities in Utah that have geologic hazard ordinances on the books, like Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, Draper, Sandy, et cetera, where if you were going to do development in those zones, then you would have to do these investigations to find where the fault is before a permit is granted. And then back up to the Riverdale landslide. One of the problems with this landslide is it moves extremely fast. When a large piece of this somewhat clean sand calves off, falls down into that lower area that you can see in the background there, there's springs, it then turns into a mud flow and flows out, is about 10 to 15, 20 seconds tops. So you can't react in that amount of time or get out of the way. Most of the landslides we have in Utah, you can walk faster than they move. And so, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to kill somebody, you might hurt somebody. But this landslide was particularly dangerous. The city called us in with their emergency manager and fire chief, and you know, we expressed, you know, the issues quite quickly. They were able to get out, put fencing around it, keep kids out, keep looky-loos and everybody out. Nobody's been hurt or killed here. Well, whatever you want to call, you know, call it, you know, people want to drive by and take pictures. And so this landslide, it keeps dumping all this mud down, and it's been backing up, I guess, those are from railroad tracks that go up I-84 and Ogden Canyon. And so they've been doing some cleanup to try to make sure that their tracks are open as well. And unfortunately, there's four homes that are condemned. And this picture is a little bit old. I didn't have time to update it, but the swing set that you see on the right, it's now over the hill. This little retaining wall, it's gone. And over half of that garage is undermined. And here any day, at least a good portion of the garage will be going down the hill. But there was time that the city was able to work with the homeowners to get them out safely. There was one home that had asbestos in it, and so the city paid for asbestos abatement, so there wouldn't be that environmental problem. All the utilities have been shut off, and the area fenced off. Unfortunately, there are a few people that do have mortgages on these homes, and so they're having to work with their mortgage companies to deal with the amount that they owe, because any kind of landslide or what they call earth movement is not covered under homeowners insurance. So it's a sad story that slowly moves along. But as you can see, I mean, it's quite dangerous. If you were standing anywhere near this base, near vertical scarp, it could fail at any time. It's a almost cohesionless sand, and so it would just, like a trap door pulling out from under you, you know, falling into the pool. That's kind of the way this landslide works, and so we've had to be very careful working around this. And there's also two groundwater monitoring wells that are in the street to the right.
What's the age of that house? Do you remember?
They were built in the late 60s. It was before, you know, anybody was really thinking about a lot of geologic hazards. It was before there was a state building code. And so, you know, the state of practice at the time was, you know, a home was built and that's the way it was. And so you really can't blame anybody here. When you get to more newer items, when we do have a state building code and, you know, we do know about these hazards and things like that, then
that's really a different story.
It's a different story.
There's somebody to sue. I just can't say that. You have litigant opportunity.
One of the problems here is the watershed for this goes all the way up to the Wasatch Front, and with people adding all these homes, people tend to overwater their yards, and so the regional groundwater table here has increased significantly. Prior to development, you know, when you went back to that earlier picture here, there was very little vegetative growth here prior to all that development. Now it's a thicket of undergrowth and trees and springs all along there. Some of the springs are diverted for agricultural use. And so groundwater is raised, and it's caused quite a few of these landslides along the bluff. And with LIDAR data that can actually penetrate and see through that, you can see scarp after scarp after scarp of landslides to the left and right of this photo.
Yeah.
And there's been multiple landslides and debris flows on both sides of the Weaver River. And so another project we've had that started probably 8-9 years ago, back when Pete worked for Manti LaSalle there in Price, is to do these landslide inventory mapping. And Pete and others were working on management plans in the forest, and as part of that, the Manti has some pretty bad actors of geologic units for landslides, and we're having management problems with it. And so Pete asked us to partner with them, and we've continued after Pete's retirement on mapping landslides. And so the areas in green are areas that we're currently in under contract or will be here in the next week or two for mapping landslides. And these map both the boundaries of landslides and describe them in an attribute table in GIS. And so it's not just a map with, you know, polygons around it. There's actual data behind it, like what kind of landslide it is. Can we identify movement ranges based on aerial photography? Things like that.
And then with those attributes, you can carry that to a general risk.
Yep.
Yeah. So if it's dormant, slow moving, it's different than active in terms of risk. Is this upper green part the response to the Coal Hollow fire?
It is.
And Trail Mountain fire?
That is correct. And in response to those fires, that area, you know, the Starvation Creek, Soldier Creek, Mill Forks, Lower Soldier Creek, those areas were added as a response to those fires. And these kind of irregular boundaries are hydrologic boundaries. And so we try to map on these hydrologic boundaries rather than just, you know, square areas. It just makes it easier for management purposes.
Is that uppermost green triangle right there near Red Narrows?
The lower Seven
Creek?
Yeah.
Looks like it.
I believe so.
Yeah.
And so the eventual plan is to map all of that area just as the Forest Service has funding. We do it on a 50-50 cost share basis with them. And then this black crosshatch area, that's area that has already been mapped and that data has been provided to them. And so this just shows you further on down the Wasatch Plateau on the Manti. There's still, you know, quite a bit of areas like that Sealy fire, that kind of irregular piece out there to the middle right, that was done in response to the Sealy fire. One of the problems there was after that fire through Huntington Canyon, there was massive political pressure to open that canyon and all the campgrounds to use. Well, the Forest Service and Pete recognized there's a huge debris flow hazard here, because a lot of these campgrounds are at the mouths of where these debris flows would come down. And so Pete was able to change the contract. We got in, did a bunch of mapping. They were able to show that kind of temper the political pressure on it and keep the campgrounds closed. And there were two campgrounds that were overrun.
We took a field trip.
We visited that site.
It just wiped it out.
And there were two, and at least one of those was at night. Had there been people there, there would have been deaths. And so that was a good thing that the Forest Service recognized there was a hazard, that we could get in there quick, get that mapping and the data they needed to, you know, basically put their foot down and say, no, this has to stay closed. And I think in the end, everybody realized it really was an issue. And so the mapping also goes all the way down to the Fish Lake boundary, which is just north of I-7.
Now the trick is to get the Fish Lake to think that they could use this too.
Well, we've been trying, but it's been problematic. They've had multiple forest supervisors over the years, and they just have not been interested in doing mapping, even though they have a huge landslide hazard there. And so the picture on the left, that just shows you another one of these debris flows that just kept coming down. Every time it would rain, UDOT is having to close the road, clean it up. And then over on the right is a kind of landslide debris flow that kicked off a couple weeks ago up Pinecrest Canyon, which is just up Immigration above the U. Fortunately, no real property damage other than just some cleanup on the road, no injuries or death, but we've been working with the county on that problem. And just to let everybody know, there's been over 15 deaths from debris flow since 1923, and the bulk of those have been at night in campgrounds.
In Utah?
In Utah. And these debris flows can travel up to 60, 65 miles an hour, so you can't outrun them. And even a vehicle, you know, in narrow canyons, you can't drive on a dirt road at 65. So.
And we've dodged some bullets, too, because, for instance, the Pinchot campground at 12 Mile was totally destroyed, but nobody was there.
It was there.
Yeah.
You know, there's campground picnic benches and everything that are totally buried by the debris flows, and then of course as erosions come through, here are these foundations and part of the camp's benches that are there. So it is
a skeleton or two.
It is quite so. Not everything about hazards is bad, but you know, rockfall hazards have been another big problem. There's been at least 80 or 20 deaths from rockfall since 1850. Back in 2013 in Rockville, which is aptly named, this rock band at the very top of the picture, a large rock, rolled into a cabin-type home and an attached garage and completely demolished it, as you can see. Those timbers that are there, that are maybe 8 to 10 feet long, they were the longest 2x4s that were there. Everything else was no more than about 2 feet. It was like a bomb had actually gone off in the house. And unfortunately, two people perished in that that incident. And then a year earlier, down in St. George, there was a kind of an absentee homeowner who only lived in the house a few months of the year. Irrigation system malfunctioned, flooded the backyard, and knocked off a rock fall. And the rock was actually twice as big as what you see in that upper right picture. It broke apart as it rolled down. Seconds before that boulder went through that corner of the house, the woman rolled over on her husband's side of the bed, who had left on a work trip. If she hadn't rolled over, it would have been a fatality. And even with that, she had lacerations down to both leg bones. And so it was pretty rough.
That one didn't stop before it hit the window.
No. The other one was at Ivins. It wasn't that
Yeah, not that far away.
Yeah.
And there's been a variety of rock fall, like at Glen Canyon, where people will park their boats underneath those alcoves.
Yeah.
Rocks will come down and either hit their boat, or sink their boat.
I know people that that's happened to.
Yeah. Wow. That's a very common event.
We had a project several years ago where we had a contract with to go map Lake Powell for that. Had a board field trip and went and looked at some of the sites.
And so we do.
We need another board trip. I've never been on Lake Powell.
And so we do.
And so we need one.
I'm going to do it next year. Down by the dam and the area up by High Cross.
Do I get to choose?
This would have been a good year to go. It's going to be full.
And then every year, every other year, the state of Utah, through the survey and the Utah Automated Geographic Reference Center, which is up at the state capitol, we try to pull together these consortia of people that have funding to collect LIDAR data. And is everybody familiar with that, or do you want me to just give a quick little splurge of what it is?
Who doesn't know what LIDAR is?
Okay. A single-engine plane with a port in the bottom of it, similar to you take aerial photography. Instead of having a camera through the port, it has a LIDAR instrument, kind of like a theodolite for survey, but it shoots billions of pulses of light to the ground they hit the ground, then they reflect back. And so you can make very detailed topographic maps. So instead of a 7.5 minute map that, you know, maybe has a 40 or 60 foot contour interval, with the data we're collecting, you can get down to 1 foot or better.
Yeah.
And so the accuracies, you know, you're most of the time we're down in the 2 inch, 3 inch accuracy tops, sometimes even better than that.
For vertical resolution?
Yes.
Or for horizontal?
Vertical error.
Vertical error. Yeah.
And okay. You're seeing through the trees.
And you're seeing you see through vegetation.
Yeah.
And so the data comes back, and you'll either have a XYZ point every 1 meter or every 1.5 meter. So you can think of about every 3 feet or every 1.5 foot. And then you can drape that imagery over it to make a 3D image. We also use it to map faults because you can, with processing, like with low sun angle photography, you can do the same thing with this LiDAR data and see fault scarps that you can't see in the field very easily. You can actually see fault scarps that you could walk across and really not even know that they're a fault scarp. But anyway, it's a complicated process to acquire it correctly and to process it, and so vendors do that for the state. And so we pull together, you know, if somebody's got $500 or they've got $1.5 million, which happened last year, we pool all that together and provide one opportunity for selected vendors to bid on it. And so instead of, you know, every little municipality having to go through all this contracting, they just do a 1 or 2 page MOU with the state, transfer the money, a year later the data shows up, reviewed, and everything's good. And the way it works with the vendors is it's a draw schedule, so they don't get all their money until they pass certain performance standards. And if the data doesn't meet all the specs at the end, they don't get 100% of the money. And so it's worked out really well. The area in the red crosshatch is what was collected last summer, over 13,000 square miles, which is a very substantial portion. It includes most of the northern part of Box Elder County, most of Rich County, and then that whole Tuolumne Valley and kind of west of Sandsbury. And then continues on down the Sevier River drainage. The bulk of the money was paid for through a program called FEMA Risk Map, and that funds flood mapping. And so the FEMA flood maps that you see, in order to make newer versions, you have to use LiDAR data. And NRCS funded, and then a variety of different municipalities and other agencies. The Forest Service had a little money in it. We had a little money, et cetera. And so that way we can get really low per square mile rates by giving these great big packages out.
So is that the Mantile cell that you got?
There is not a whole lot of the Mantilla Cell. There's an area out there south and southwest of Price that NRCS paid for.
Oh, okay.
And so it goes up to the forest boundary, but that's about it.
Oh.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Does it cover that new Garley Wash proposal out
yes.
by the... It does?
I believe it covers the Garley Wash.
Oh, boy, I need to bring that forward. They don't know that.
And so that there's a black line through the middle of it. What's on the left, if I remember right, is half meter data, and what's on the right is 1 meter data. And then the kind of a light gray shade is other data that's been collected over the years. And then this year, with some more FEMA money, it's going to cover that light green area, mainly down there in the south part of the state, including most of King County. So if anybody, you know, needs LiDAR data, the state does these acquisitions pretty much every year now. And so I try to bring together, find the funding and the money and the people, and then AGRC will usually handle the contracting end of this. So we just kind of share the duties on it. And so these geologic hazard maps, there's usually anywhere from 10 to 14 maps per 7.5 minute quad is kind of our typical map size, and we just do that more for convenience. All of the data is actually seamless. If you take quads, put them together, everything matches together. And online with the Utah Geologic Hazards database that we're developing, everything's seamless in there. And so they're typically in these stoplight colors to make it easy for people to understand. Red high hazard, green low hazard, and yellow in between. And those colored lines with stars, those just show rockfall paths down in Rockville. And not surprisingly, all those are in the red high hazard zone. Now, a lot of places you could mitigate a rockfall hazard. Unfortunately, in Rockville, the rocks are of such a size that they're starting to get outside of the bounds of normal.
Build a wall!
normal rockfall mitigation.
I'll take your politics and your role.
You know, for New York State, you can go ahead and put
I'll show you the wall. I want to
know
what it did to it.
I-beams and the rockfall netting and all that, you're not going to be doing that for single family homes. It's just not cost effective because it costs way more than the home and the lot does. But it does help the city and the county, you know, move development hopefully to less hazardous areas there. And we've on the right hand, it just shows you the 7.5 minute quads and then larger areas that have been mapped that are done today. There's a variety of maps that are in progress, and then Bryce Canyon National Park and the south half of Moab Spanish Valley is up next. And these just show what the PDFs look like. We've been providing these prior to having this online mapping application where, you know, those that don't have GIS and the more sophisticated, expensive software can use it. Once we go to this online mapping, similar to the geologic mapping portal, we'll probably discontinue the PDFs just because the cartography takes a huge amount of time. And the map on the left just shows surface fault rupture. The black lines are the faults, and the red area are these special study zones. And then the map on the right just shows liquefaction potential, liquefaction susceptibility, again, in this red high hazard up to the green low. And then we mentioned these guidelines. Of course, the UGS isn't a regulatory agency, but we've created these guidelines, and there were versions that went back about 15 years. Several years ago, Bill Lund and I and others in the program pulled all those together into one publication, added some new ones, and completely revised them to make them more up to date. Got rid of a lot of redundancy between the guidelines. And these are to help consultants and landowners and city and county planners deal with these hazards. Of what are the minimum kind of standards for investigating hazards, how to report on these hazards, and then how for the city to review these reports. You know, when you turn in a building plan, there'll be a plan reviewer that will go through and look to make sure that you've met the current building code. Well, geotech and geology reports should be reviewed as well because there may be some deficiencies in there. You never know. And so these guidelines help cities deal with that problem. And in some places, these guidelines are enacted in their local government ordinances. And there's a variety of other hazard background information. There's four appendices that go with this to provide more information as well. And then this summer, we're hoping to get a new radon gas hazard guideline out because since 1973, there's been over 5,600 deaths from radon gas. And radon gas is this radioactive, odorless, colorless, tasteless gas that when it gets on dust, or if you're a smoker, gets on that smoke, when you inhale the dust or the smoke, well, now you have a radioactive source in your lungs, and lo and behold, you can get lung cancer. Unfortunately, the Department of Health data only goes back to 1973, so if you went back to statehood, you know, that would probably triple that number.
So how do they determine a radon death? Is it like cancers that they've got?
Yes.
That they've attributed to radon?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's not an exact number because
sure.
They have to back out, you know, lung cancer from smoking, lung cancer from occupational hazards. And so epidemiologists or those that study you know, medical diseases and their occurrence have gone through and developed essentially equations to kind of help estimate that.
Even that must also include miners from the uranium days.
That's correct.
But they from high radon.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
So are they showing correlations with communities like Beaver, which have really high levels?
Yes, there are correlations that exist like that.
And you have a map where those high levels are?
We do not. The Department of Health and Environmental Quality, their radon program, which is kind of like a very small effort of one person because of funding, there are some statewide maps. They're only released to the public based on zip code. Because of proprietary health information and things like that, we have used the individual site data before, but we have to keep it confidential.
But wouldn't just emanation of radon at different levels be something that we could just map?
Well, it's a quite complicated. One of the issues with radon is you could take the same geology, the same contractor, build the same building, say, five times, have the same use of the building, test it, and you'll get five different values.
But how about just background for the area?
It's challenging to do, to measure radon gas emanating out of the ground.
Also manage how well your house is ventilated and how it's ventilated.
There's a host of issues. And so there are some test methods where you essentially take a tarp, seal it to the ground, and put a radon concentrator, a detector in it. But there's a lot of error with it, and there has not been a whole lot of confidence in the methods of saying you have this value, you're going to have this value when you build a building.
I had a home in Colorado that when we bought it, they detected high concentrations in the bed, and they put in a ventilation system.
We put in a ventilation system
at price, too.
Yeah. Our values are not super high, but just to be safe.
In Utah, there is no area that's low, low hazard. It's all moderate to high based on the test data we have. And then, was in the 70s and 80s, there was the NURI program.
Naturally occurring radioactive.
Yeah.
NURA.
Norm.
Naturally occurring radioactive material.
Yep. So there's somewhat statewide data from that, and we've used that as part of our mapping as well.
Oh, okay.
To look at what are these units that could be potentially susceptible. One of the problems that we found is you might have a unit like the Manning Canyon Shale that's relatively high in uranium. A groundwater flows through it, picks that up, and that radon gas actually gets transported somewhere else where those quaternary units really don't have much of that uranium to create radon gas, but now it's been transported. And so it's a very complicated subject of, you know, it can get transported like that, and a lot more complicated than people thought and the maps in the past were based on. And then since 1850, there's been over 6,000 deaths in the state. The bulk of those, again, radon gas and then from landslides. And the photo on the left just shows a World War II era 5-ton 6x6 truck. And you know, those trucks were built quite beefy and no plastic. You can see this rockfall that completely crushed that down like a Tonka toy. And this is up near the existing maintenance facility for Zion National Park. And several years ago, they actually built a rockfall fence to protect those structures because they're on the historic register. And there was one building that's been hit multiple times, and the photographs show a hole in the roof almost in the exact same place every time.
Funnel.
Uncanny how that same spot in the roof has been hit so many times.
Yeah.
And of course, this doesn't include all of the economic losses from excess maintenance. You know, with these problem soils, if you've got collapsible soils or expansive soils and, say, flat work, you know, a sidewalk moves, somebody trips on it, that's usually over $100,000 in legal fees. And so that goes a long way for doing geotech work and just doing a little bit more work in construction. You know, and that doesn't include all the other problems, you know, in the building itself that you might have for this. Issues.
I will tell you that when I went to build my home in Hurricane last summer, I pulled from the state the maps, the PDFs of expansive, compactive soils. I just wanted to have a look at my own.
And so really talking about these hazards, you know, we really want to iterate. It's not a negative and a development message. It's really more smart growth and smart development is what it really comes down to. And in some areas, maybe you don't do, you know, development A here. Maybe you move it over to some other area with land use zoning. And maybe you do open space or a park or some other land use there where those hazards may not be easily mitigated or maybe it's too expensive. And so we're hoping through planning and just better thought, we can really reduce these hazards. Because if you go back to this picture here, which we call the Parkway Drive landslide up in North Salt Lake, that's on the front cover there. You can see there's a home in the lower right-hand corner that was demolished. Fortunately, there was an older woman in a wheelchair, and she was able to get out of the home quick enough. If it had been another 15 minutes, it might have been a collapse for her. But this landslide was preventable. There was a landslide that occurred here prior to development. It was an aggregate quarry that had been mined. And during the reclamation, there were multiple landslides. Nobody came and asked us. We had photos that showed where these were. And then up at the head of the landslide, you can see a drill rig doing some work up there. To the right of that, there was a drainage, and that was just end-dumped. They never did proper site prep of getting in there and benching in properly to help key in that extra soil that was added to the top of this now landslide. And just behind where that drill rig is are the two 36-inch high-pressure gas mains that serve the bulk of Las Vegas's gas supply. And so Kern River, Questar, and others spent several hundred thousand dollars in trying to deal with this, because of course they didn't want that shut off. And the city spent a bunch of money on dealing with their utilities down there. And of course, that just goes to taxpayers and ratepayers.
And didn't the rec center there cut out the toe of the slide?
There was when this tennis facility, white kind of semi-temporary building there.
Yeah.
That building that's in the picture to the right of the text, it's damaged enough that it can't be occupied.
But they cut out the part of the toe to put
part of the toe out. And so how much that contributed is still in litigation.
Yeah, okay.
But it's super dangerous. The landslide has been regraded. That scarp up there at the top, that's gone. And it's regraded down to the home it's demolished. But the area behind the tennis club hasn't been because of the ongoing litigation. But there's a near vertical slope there where rocks come down, and there's no fencing or anything around it, so kids can go over there and play. And there's a what's called a rock block wall. They're 2x2x4 foot concrete blocks that you can make a retaining wall out of. Some of those have fallen over. I mean, if anyone was there and there was a rock come over a part of that retaining wall, there'd be a fatality, but unfortunately it hasn't been fenced or anything. And then part of the other part we do is provide data to the public. And one of the ways we've been doing this, as part of this geologic hazard mapping, we collect a huge amount of data, including geotechnical reports, geologic reports, when they're turned in as part of city and county permit reviews for buildings. And these were coming in so fast we couldn't deal with it. And so what we did is it's been 10 years ago, we started a process to scan all of our files, all the file cabinets, all of our slides and photos, and the work that is now done, and I think we'll have it done July, August. And it's in this archive. It's mainly hazard stuff, and wetlands has a substantial amount in there. And there's over 59,000 items that are in. This just shows you our digital clearinghouse of information for the Pinecrest Canyon landslide that took off a couple weeks ago. And so as we're out doing recon on it, taking photos, different things like that, all those get uploaded, and that way that the county and others can go right to this digital clearinghouse and take a look at it. And also provide the long-term record of the landslide, because there's been multiple landslides in nearly the same place, and so you can go back and take a look at that. And so if you were to click on any of those items, say you click on this particular photo, there's a quick photo of it, you can download it, and then all this metadata down at the bottom is all text searchable as well. So if you type in anything, you can search that. And then another part that we've done is to scan about 100,000 air photos across the state, and our geologic mapping program, they use that to map, create geologic maps. We use it to map faults and other hazards. And a lot of times we've got to go back before development so we can actually see what was there before everything was obliterated with grading and structures. And so these older aerial photos, typically before 1950, 1960, are particularly valuable. And so the figure on the bottom just shows you where our current system looks like. If you were to click on any of those little dots, that would give you an individual photo that shows you the photo center point.
So Steve, are you about done? We're about out of time.
Two slides and that's it.
Okay.
And so we're currently working on porting this over to a new system because it's over 10 years old and it's getting quite challenging to support because it's so old. And so there's a variety of data we have online. We're moving all of our hazard maps post-2008 into this new geologic hazard database where you can type an address or a parcel number in and go right to that area and see what we have. And there's a whole variety of other data, including the Q faults that are all on that map there. And that's it. And so just basically last we wrap up, we can prepare for and deal with these hazards. They're not Chicken Little or anything like that. It's just, you know, we need to deal with them and, you know where they are and how to deal with them in some places of work.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very much.
We're, you know, about 12 people and quite overextended at the moment. But.
As we all are.
Okay.
Are there any questions? Okay, we're on to the last section.
Chairman?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I will.
Item?
Gladly.
Great meeting with all you.
Thanks, Tom.
By the way, I believe your gravel was donated by Chuck Zimborski.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh,
a coal mining guy.
Yes.
Yeah, I knew him.
I forget whether he handcrafted it or...
I like
sure
it.
I'm sure he did, yeah.
Thank you.
See you, Tom.
Took me quite a while to remember that.
See you later.
You did well. You did well. Okay.
So, let's see.
How do you want to handle this?
Who stays in the room for the discussion?
Are we going to do that first part first about the criteria? And
yeah, we can do that.
And we don't...
We can have a discussion of the criteria in public. Probably should have that in public.
Yeah, because there's a because you mentioned it in your report that there were some concerns about our selections.
Yeah,
and
I'll let Mike address that.
Yeah, tell us about that.
I wasn't here.
So in recent years, some UGS staff have expressed frustration over past selections.
Yeah.
So that made me go back and look at the list, and I've been here as long as anybody has, and I am comfortable with all the things I voted for.
Yeah, and that's good. I mean, this is. I'll start out by saying, you know, this is not any kind of indictment of the current board, but for maybe 15, 16, 17 years going back now, I occasionally hear people commenting on selections that have been made. Initially, the one that always stuck in my mind was a former UGS geologist who, after receiving a Crawford Award, told me that he thought that the award was, in his words, a joke. And that always, I mean, it bothered me at that time.
What did he mean by that?
It has stuck with me since.
Did he cash the check?
Yeah,
that's
opinion,
the real proof, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
That in his opinion, the selection of what of his and others' work relative to the other nominees, it didn't seem to line up in his mind. Some comments that have been shared with me are that people feel like it's more the publication that's getting the award. Maybe, you know, the potential usefulness of the publication, you know, out in the community.
That's in the criteria, though.
It is.
Versus, well, it is.
It's supposed to greatly enhance the understanding of Utah geology and our science.
The work, right, the work. So I think how...
Well, the work doesn't do that if it isn't published.
That's true. That's
so,
true.
And it's got to be...
There are
this is yours to choose.
Yes.
Pardon?
But this is yours to choose.
Well, yeah. I mean,
there are instances where the publication is the result of a substantial scientific effort.
Right.
So original science being done by the authors. And there are some publications that are great publications, you know, don't get me wrong, where they're more of a compilation maybe of other people's work.
Well, we have one of those today.
Yeah, so...
On produced water.
Well, there's a...
Well, there's a huge amount of work, but it's been done by enough people so that if you gave everybody a part of the award, they'd get $100 a piece.
That's not an issue, how many people, but how much kind of original scientific work...
Well, I mean, we gave it to why is Bear Lake Blue.
Yeah, that's...
Did that take some people off?
It did.
Well, the only thing is that probably more copies of that got distributed to the public than... anything else that was on the list that year.
So there's the discussion point, I guess.
Yeah.
Is
I mean,
you know, is it the is it the value of that publication for maybe, you know, educating people, or is it the...
Or being of interest to kids?
Yeah.
Which or is why it, that one got
or, or is it something more, you know, the research and science aspect of the authors of that report?
I'm comfortable with that explanation. Yeah, it's just people who don't think the same way I do, and that's tough. They can go get on the board.
That's the bottom line, is it comes down to, you know, you all making that decision. And
well, I think that the board over time has tried, first of all, there are two selections involved here. There's the directors and the staff or whoever he involves in getting a limited number to us. Three.
And we invite anybody in the organization to submit.
Right. So we're not involved in that at all.
No.
And then you give us choices and we read the choices and decide. And honestly, I don't think that the decision has been made on the same basis over a period of time, but I think it's been made consistent with the instructions.
Okay.
And I mean, sometimes it has been to reward outstanding scientific work. Sometimes it has been to reward maybe not so competitive scientific work, but a presentation that made it more valuable. I mean, it's the understanding of geology and the earth science in Utah
has had a major influence on.
And so I'm more than happy to, if anybody else wants to talk, and I've talked way more than I should have today, I'm the reason we're late, but this financing thing is the most important thing going on here.
So we put it in there thinking that it's just good that it's there, that it's a conscious...
We've expressed what some of the staff have expressed.
I thought it was losers. I didn't realize it was a winner.
So with that in mind, the
I only had the losers... I mean, I wasn't around when it happened, but from what I'm hearing, it wasn't the losers that complained.
Yeah.
So the part about original scientific work, that isn't... There exactly, and if there's a feeling like that should be a consideration along with what is there, should we modify the criteria?
That's maybe a good question.
Yeah, I don't know who writes the criteria. Is that the board?
I don't know who wrote the criteria. It's not changed since I've been here.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't.
Because there could be a paper that represented something really valuable to the state, but wasn't anywhere near as high a level scientific investigation as another one that benefited a smaller area. And so if either one could be considered, we might need to revise the criterion.
Personally, I'm comfortable the way we do it, and I'm comfortable with people not being happy about it, especially if they got a $1,600 check. I can only be so unhappy about that. Pardon?
There's dissenters.
There's always.
Yeah, that's right.
But we just have an obligation to share.
Yeah, I understand that, but it's not a large number of people, obviously.
No, but it is just kind of an
undercurrent.
Undercurrent is a good...
And we do struggle with the decisions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's sometimes it's like... They're all good.
They are all level.
Yeah.
What do we do?
They don't get to us unless they're good.
Yeah.
I spent a day reading through all of them because some of them are long.
Oh God, these.
And I didn't read them, so and I chose those two, so you can blame me.
Done. Okay, so any more discussion on this, or should we close her up and?
So we're good with keeping the criteria the way they are.
Unless somebody says they want to change it, and then we'll have to defer that to after we've investigated how it gets written or how it got written to begin with.
You don't want to change it before this one.
No. We can't do that. So,
because I try to use the criteria as
And just in the interest of time, is there any reason that we need to come back into public meeting session after we make this decision, because it's the last thing on the agenda now? And
I move that after we're done, we're done.
Okay. So is there a second to the motion? Okay, so it's been moved and seconded that the meeting ends now and we have the discussion, the non-public discussion in closed session for the Crawford Award, and then we will not come back into session.